wearebe.com. And my apologies to people that are on dial-up because it takes forever to load. And my apologies to Mac users, a lot of you who can't access the site. And if Bill, if you're listening, we're going to launch the new one, right, on Wednesday. That's my webmaster, Bill. And because we've been kind of waiting for me to transfer the data and stop making it so, I don't know what to even call it. There's too much on there. You know, it just goes on vertically forever. And, I, you know, what do I know? I don't know about these things. I just see things, I copy it, and I paste it. So if you've been having trouble, just hang on. Try it like on Thursday or something like that. All right. One of the things we're always talking about is talk, right? You know, what people are saying, how they're saying it. And I think maybe tonight we are going to talk a bit about language. We are going to talk some about those subjects that some of you write me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com and say, why are you still talking about that? Why do you talk about Iraq every single week? Why do you talk about the economy every single week? Well, I guess what I would say is what I always say. You know, call 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-WRIF, and you raise the subject. Right now, there's no calls because you're kind of waiting patiently to see what I'm going to talk about. Well, if you don't want to talk about Iraq, if you don't want to talk about the economy, then bring up some other subjects. Now, one of the reasons that I talk about those things is because those are the big news items. And this is a public affairs show. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. But let's have you play a role in this as well. Now, let's go back to what I just mentioned about language. And part of it is my language. Someone was really disturbed by something I said, and we'll get to that in a second. But can you imagine, only in America do you get this kind of flap about something like that. Actually, I thought, I had two versions of this. This is from the right-wing Rupert Murdoch New York Post. It used to be a liberal paper, and then this guy Murdoch buys it and turns it into a right-wing paper. And this is in the middle of New York City, you know, one of the most liberal cities in the country. Anyways, John Kerry fired an X-rated attack on President Bush over Iraq and used the F-word. Highly unusual language, says Deborah Oren in the New York Post, for a presidential contender in a stunning new interview with Rolling Stone magazine. One can only imagine that the editors of Rolling Stone are saying, oh, thank you, John Kerry, thank you, New York Post, because, you know, what's the deal? Any publicity is good publicity as long as they spell your name right. Now, Kerry, who is a senator from Massachusetts, along with Ted Kennedy, used the undeleted expletive to express his frustration and anger over how the Iraq issue has hurt him because he voted for the war resolution, while Democratic frontrunner Howard Dean, who is the former governor of Vermont, has soared by opposing it. Now, here's what he said. They said Kerry said this to the youth-oriented magazine. Well, I mean, I think, don't you think that sort of across the board, there's a wonderful issue. I wonder if it's in this one. Let's see. Does it say John Kerry? This is the they probably got a new one out. December 11th. And this is actually an incredible album. It's the 500 greatest albums of all times. Great issue, rather. 500 greatest albums of all time. And number one, the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper. Yeah, I mean, okay, maybe you don't think so, but that's what the experts voted, if you will. And this one has a Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Article called Bush's Crimes Against the Environment. This is not mistakes or bad policy or anything like that. Again, we're talking about language. Bush's Crimes Against the Environment. And probably most of you, unfortunately, because it takes some delving into things to that you don't know the extent to which the Bush administration has turned guarding the hen house over to the foxes. Those are the polluters, the industrialists, the waste haulers. That's who's making policy. The energy giants that are poisoning us more and more. And that's why Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says it's Bush's crimes against the environment. So that's a lead story in the December 11th Rolling Stone. Now, here's what that Senator Kerry said. He voted for the war resolution. So he's complicit in all of this, and he's like treading water, you know, trying to get out from under it. But he said, I voted for what I thought was best for the country. Did I expect Howard Dean to go off to the left and say, I'm against everything? Sure. Did I expect George Bush to F it up as badly as he did? I don't think anybody did. That's what Kerry said. Again, Kerry said, did I expect George Bush to F it up as badly as he did? I don't think anybody did. That's what he said. And Brookings Institution presidential scholar Stephen Hess says he can't recall another candidate attacking a president with X-rated language in a public interview. And let's see, Kerry was accurately quoted in Rolling Stone, said his spokesman David Wade, adding the X-rated language reflects the fact that Bush's Iraq policy makes John Kerry's blood boil. Kerry yesterday angrily cited his war record in Vietnam when asked by a New Hampshire student about charges that it's unpatriotic to attack the commander-in-chief, fuming, this is Kerry, I left some blood on a battlefield that President Bush never left anywhere. You remember, you know, Bush is a draft dodger, a scamster. His rich daddy got him out of the draft and into the Texas Air National Guard because of his connections. Way, you know, a big waiting line. He just jumped ahead. Go to AWOLBush.com if you don't believe me. Now, Andrew Card says that's beneath John Kerry. That's the president's chief of staff. He says he'd like to see an apology. Now, you got to remember that the Bush is not, he's not this nicey-nice Christian guy. Yeah, he's this mean SOB that really opens up on people he doesn't like. Remember that he was talking, wasn't it to Cheney on the campaign trail, and he called somebody an a-hole, you know? And then he ran into Condoleezza Rice's office and said, we're taking effing Saddam out. You know, this was in a Time magazine article. So, you know, Bush uses these kind of words all the time, and, you know, see him as this pious guy that would never use that, and get all upset about John Kerry. Or should we? Do you think it's inappropriate for John Kerry to say, let's see it again, did I expect George Bush to F it up as badly as he did talking about Iraq? I don't think anybody did. Even Newt Gingrich, this far right-wing character, has been critical of the Bush administration's handling of the war. All right, more on language. So you tell me, 313-298-WRIF or calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Can't find my sheet I'm looking for. Oh, I got too much on here. Speaking about rolling, well, here, let's get in more into language before I get into this other thing. The Secret Service is planning to interview Eminem after President Dead rap. That's what he said. They're planning to conduct an interview with Eminem because he's got a new song that wished the president dead. And that's a quote. And a well-placed government source directly involved in the matter says, we take all matters involving comments about the death of a sitting president very seriously. Personally, I found it quite alarming and reckless. In the song, the rapper declares that he would not perform only for cash. I don't rap for dead presidents, Eminem says. I'd rather see the president dead. It's never been said, but I set precedents in the standards, and they can't stand it. I mean, it's kind of inappropriate to talk about anybody dying. And it's a federal crime. So old Eminem may have himself in a bit of a jam, don't you think? And before we get off of Rolling Stone, which I mentioned, this has the interview with John Kerry. There's in the December 11th issue, the collectors, this is one of the most incredible issues of any rock and roll magazine I've ever seen. Special collectors issue, the 500 greatest albums of all times. There's almost too much here to be able to to fasten on, to integrate into the old brain. But the lead article, the lead news article, is called Rockers Unite to Oust Bush. Bruce Springsteen told a crowd of 50,000 New Yorkers on October 14th to, quote, shout a little louder if you want the president impeached. That's John Mellencamp. I'm sorry, that's Bruce Springsteen. John Mellencamp posted an open letter to America on his website declaring, quote, we've been lied to and terrorized by our own government, and it's time to take action. Meanwhile, Moby, Eddie Vedder, Michael Stipe from REM are organizing a TV ad campaign that will run anti-Bush commercials during the week of the State of the Union address in January. Dave Matthews is railing against the war in Iraq in interviews. And at press time, at least three multi-band rock tours plan to take aim at Bush administration policies. Green Day, No Effects, Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine, Dixie Chicks, Don Henley, Willie Nelson, and Steve Earle have all played or planned to play for political candidates or causes opposed to Bush. Hip-hop stars have also gotten involved. And welcome to the partisan world of popular music, where President George W. Bush is a marked man, according to Rolling Stone. 30 major artists interviewed for this story cited many concerns. U.S. policy on Iraq, the Patriot Act, the Bush administration's assault on the environment, the economy, and the media. But they all agreed that as the 2004 presidential election gets closer, it is time to mobilize. Says Moby, the America we believe in cannot survive another 4 years of George Bush. Lou Reed, one of my faves, from the old Velvet Underground. We must all unite and work for whomever opposes Bush, regardless of whatever differences we may have. And this goes on and on and on. You can go for some of these bands like No Effects, Green Day, and Offspring. You can go to punkvoter.com, punkvoter.com. Billy Nelson, he's behind Dennis Kucinich. All right, so, language. Here's what someone said about me. Do I have this? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, someday I've got to go into someone else's talk show studio and see how they set everything up. It couldn't be this mess that I have here. Anyways, here is what Joel writes to me. I'm writing as a former listener, so Joel might not be listening to this, who has agreed with many of your views and disagreed with some. Never have I heard anything so outrightly offensive on your show until the whole deal with Rush Limbaugh came about. I don't and never have agreed with the views that he routinely expresses. So he doesn't agree with Rush Limbaugh. However, it seems to be somewhat, quote, below the belt for so-called compassionate liberals such as yourself to mock the man because of his disease, that is, addiction. I am not so much worried about the man as I am about the message that you send to other people struggling and recovering from drug and or alcohol addiction. To use phrases such as Pillhead Limbaugh, that's what I call him and what I have on my website, or attacking the guy for admitting he is a pill-popping addict, is no less offensive to the recovery community as it would be to the African-American community to throw around the N-word or to the gay community to say fag or queer. You have mentioned on your show the oxymoron of compassionate conservatism. You know, they're mutually exclusive categories. You have claimed that liberals are by nature more compassionate than conservatives. Well, that's sure true. Everybody knows that. While I generally may agree with some of this, the derogatory language and content you insist on including in your show demonstrates that you are clearly an exception to this principle. Well, okay. All right. So we admit that liberals are, you know, overwhelmingly more compassionate, but I've fallen. I'm a fallen compassionate liberal. I hope that in the future you might find less cruel and obnoxious means to express your opinions. So, your opinions on that. Am I being hypocritical? Or am I being insensitive by referring to Rush Limbaugh as Pillhead Limbaugh and a pill-popping addict? Now, here's what's going on here. This is what Limbaugh is saying. He read from a statement on his show by his attorney, Roy Black. What these, you know, there was this raid on these doctor's offices because what Rush was doing was he was what they call doctor shopping. So he needed all these pills to feed his addiction. So he would go to one doctor and have these overlapping prescriptions without the other doctors knowing. So this is what Limbaugh read this, and this is actually the statement of, this is so weird. He's reading the statement of his lawyer about him. What these records show, the ones that were seized, is that Mr. Limbaugh suffered extreme pain and had legitimate reasons to get pain medication. Unfortunately, because of Mr. Limbaugh's prominence and well-known political opinions, he has been subjected to an invasion of privacy no citizen of this republic should enjoy. He said that Limbaugh did not become a target of State Attorney Barry Krishner's painkiller investigation until the National Enquirer quoted Limbaugh's maid in October, saying that she had unlawfully sold Limbaugh these illegal medications. Now, like Limbaugh, everything that this lawyer says is a lie. This the prosecutors began investigating in December 2002, months before this article came out that Limbaugh's former maid, Wilma Klein, had sold Limbaugh large quantities of hydrocodone, OxyContin, and other pharmaceutical drugs. Now, you know, well, let me get back to something else. He says he was in extreme pain. He must have been in extraordinarily extreme pain because he got over 2,000 OxyContin pills between March 24th and September 26th. Now, do the math on that. I mean, can't. I mean, it's just, it's astounding that this man was ingesting that amount of pharmaceuticals and was that stoned out and was still doing a broadcast. I mean, I don't even know what to say. He also received prescriptions for the anti-anxiety drug Xanax and Clonidin. So, and he also, had high blood pressure. I mean, listen, let me go back to Joel's thing, and I'd like to hear from what you think about this. And actually, I'm going to be my own not so nice self. I'll play that song again about Rush before I get your calls. You know, there's a difference between sympathy and compassion. I do have compassion for Rush Limbaugh. And it's almost in this Buddhist sense. And I'm not a Buddhist, and it's almost the philosophy that comes out of it. Now, the idea, contrary to like Christian philosophy, Buddhism holds that that human beings are perfect. They have a Buddha nature, that all of us can be Buddhas. There's not one single savior or anything like that. That we all have this this Buddhist nature, but we by acts that we do of selfishness or stuff like that, we move away from it. So a Buddhist like the Dalai Lama can have compassion for the Chinese that are occupying his country, that have killed his compatriots, that have murdered and executed his friends, trampled on their temples and what have you, without having a bit of sympathy for them. I mean, you can have compassion for people that do the most awful things and understand that how far they've moved, forget about Buddhism, how far they've moved from their core humanity. On the other hand, so that means you can have compassion for a killer, but you have no sympathy for him. You have no way you're going to excuse his or her acts. So the problem with Rush Limbaugh is that he's this monstrous hypocrite, that he's made a fortune out of his political toxic diatribes against everything that's decent and trying to make this country better, and instead come down full square on the side of the powerful and the rich, claiming that the only problems in the world are essentially that liberals exist and don't let the conservative agenda, which is really nothing but a corporate agenda and a wealthy agenda, be what guides this country. So, I don't know. What do you think? Let me say one other thing about my friends. I've had friends that that have died from their addiction on a number of different ways. And I know what addiction is. There's alcoholics, recovering alcoholics in my family. So most of us have one way or another been touched by the disease of addiction. And in that sense, I have great compassion for all of these people, because I know them. They're friends of mine. I suffered personal loss because of the demons of their addiction. They're unable to slay the dragon. But when you have a man like Rush Limbaugh, so I shouldn't be saying, he had 2,000 OxyContins between March and September. That's what's into his system. No wonder, and that's why he lost his hearing, too. And yet, here's a man that so hypocritically denounced other people with addiction, say that they wasted their lives. Like Jerry Garcia from the Grateful Dead and Kurt Cobain, people like that, making fun of people that were going through rehab and couldn't make it, just like he couldn't make it. Kitty Dukakis, the wife of the 1988 Democratic presidential contender. So this is the basis of that. Although, I have to say, when I said that, I had maybe 5 to 8% reservation about it. Because I understand what addiction is and how, what it does to people. So, you tell me. Should I be referring to Limbaugh as Pillhead and what have you? Here, we're going to play that song again by Bob Rivers because people really like that last time. Let me see if I can get this rolling real quickly, and then I'll get to your calls at 313-298. Okay, did it just come up here? Let me see. See if it'll just load for us here. This is Bob Rivers. Yeah, there you go.
Well, I was in the car and I heard this guy. He sounded all shook up and he told me why. His voice was a shaking on the EIB. Sounded like an Oxycontin eater to me. It was a bug-eyed, tone-deaf, flying Oxycontin eater.
Right-wing syndicated, spinning liberal people beater.
Right-wing, strung-out, hypocrite, prescription cheater. Rush looked strange to me.
That guy!
Well, his housekeeper picked up some drugs on the street. And she brought the stuff home for the boss to eat. I heard him say in a voice so gruff,
I tried to quit twice, but it was just too tough.
He was a big mouth, blowhard, right-wing propaganda reader.
Bad ears, sore back, 30 dose of decaliter.
A three-time retread, frequent petty Ford repeater. Still looks high to me.
One more time!
I said, oh, Mr. Oxycontin guy, the show sounds fine. I see you beating up on liberals using half your mind. So what's the real reason that you're in rehab?
I want to get my job back and slam McNab.
Well, bless his soul, no control, former jelly donut eater. Dope, stashing, Clinton fashion, flying Oxycontin eater.
ESPN Sports.
Fired color commentator. What a sight to see.
Good morning, people.
After 30 short days, well, what do you know? He pops back up on his radio show. He was preaching away to the ditto heads while his maid faced the music because he sang to the feds.
I am not a victim in this. Criminals like this should be put in jail, off the streets, and are the worst kind of offenders. I blame Hillary Clinton. She's the reason for all this. I should have stuck with tequila.
101 WRIF. That's Bob Rivers. Twisted Tunes, the Oxycontin Eater. Oxycontin Eater. You can probably just put that in some search engine or Bob Rivers. Twisted Tunes. So should we have compassion and sympathy for Rush Limbaugh? Why do you think they call him Rush? All right. Your thoughts, please. 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werbe. This is the Night Call Show. Also, you can email me at calltalkyos@yahoo.com. And wait a minute here. Let me just get this. Someone says, last week's show was good, says Rizba. The sound quality was bad, and I couldn't get the show online. I can get the station online today, but I wanted you to know the sound keeps going up and down, and I couldn't get the entire show. Huh. All right. We'll see what we can do about that. Hi, this is WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, hi, Peter. How's it going?
Going great.
I want to change subject for a second.
That's okay.
What did you think of the NAACP going on accusing the Cleveland Police Department of, you know, being racist when they were subduing that criminal and they killed him?
Well,
he
wasn't a criminal. It was Cincinnati. Other than that,
oh, Cincinnati, sorry.
Yeah, the Cincinnati police kill a lot of black people, and you know, they usually have some good excuse for it. I mean, there's a minute and a half of their tape missing, and everybody said that this guy was extraordinarily, since he was, I guess he was pretty high, said he was in extraordinarily good mood and that he was rolling around on this lawn. So, I don't know. I mean, what do I think? Do I think if he's white, he'd still be alive? Yep, I do.
So you don't think that, like, the heart, the enlarged heart and the drugs?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But, you know, there's always an excuse. There's always an official excuse why these white cops wind up killing black people. And it's, you know, it's a, it winds up in, I don't know what the total figures are, but it's pretty high in America. And you could say, well, gee, it's just a coincidence or whatever, but there certainly appears on the face of it, if there's not, I mean, I wasn't there. I don't know what it was. I saw a little of the tape. It was kind of hard to see. You know, that anybody that fights the cops is pretty dumb. And yet, a lot of big police forces in this country, including Cincinnati, has a bad history of that.
So, what about based on solely on the tape, though? You don't think? I mean,
Well, I would have liked to have seen the whole tape, including the 90 seconds when they first approached them and what it was all about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then. Just wanted to get your opinion.
All right. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Another call here. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. Is this Peter Werbe?
Hey, you got it.
Hey, sir. How you doing? I just on my way home from the airport listening to your deal about Rush Limbaugh. I wanted to add a little comment in there, if
sure.
possible.
Sure. Please.
You know what? I concur with you. I don't think the man should really receive any compassion for what he's done, and he kind of shot himself in the foot. But, you know, the one thing I can't understand is how, you know, you were making a remark about how conservative politics is geared towards the rich. And,
yes.
And that's what he stands for. And I disagree with that 100%. And the one thing I want to ask you is if the conservatives are all about the rich, then what is, please define to me what the Kennedys stand for, the Gwyneth Paltrows, the Brad Pitts, the Jennifer Aniston.
All the, well, and all those rock stars that I mentioned as well.
And all the rock stars that are
well, these are people that do not support policies that that accentuate their wealth. They're very wealthy people, and, you know, from the Kennedys, and there's lots of very, very wealthy liberals, and a lot of very wealthy rock stars, and a lot of very wealthy Hollywood stars, and rather than acting out of greed, as supporters of the Republican Party do, and the policies that are all oriented towards making them wealthier at the expense of the, us, the middle class, and the working class, and the poor, they're going in the opposite direction. Like, for instance, Bill Gates' father, Bill Gates Sr., belongs to an organization called Responsible Wealth. Now, he's a multimillionaire by virtue of his son's money. And he has campaigned and leads a campaign against Bush's tax cuts that benefit way disproportionately the ultra-wealthy. So he's wealthy. But he has compassion for people. He doesn't want to maximize the wealth. The wealthy in this country are way disproportionately wealthy beyond anything they could possibly need in a country that has on the other end of things has so many poor people.
Well, that's my point about the Hollywood elite and these rock stars and stuff that constantly jam their views down your throat.
Wait, why do they jam it? And why do you say they're the elite? They're these people that we all love. You know, I mean, don't you love all these artists that I just mentioned?
Not really.
Well, then what are you looking for? Right wing, rock stars. I mean, you know, you can't go very far beyond like Kid Rock or something.
No, it's just the point. I like Ted Nugent.
Now, there you go.
Guy that's got a good conservative view on
yeah.
life. And
well, all right. So there's at least two, but there's something about the artistic soul that is generous. Because think about it. These people practice and I mean, you know, they get a lot back in money and ego strokes and, you know, gratification and all that, but they're also giving a lot. I mean, music is one of the things that enlivens our life. You know, drama and movies and all of that as well. And way disproportionately, historically, I mean, for the last 200 years, 300 years maybe, the people that entertain us have overwhelmingly been generous and liberal and tolerant, and it's the exact opposite of the conservative mindset.
Well, I disagree with that somewhat.
Well, tell me, show me all the great conservative art. I mean, there's some, you know. I mean, you know, Wagner was an anti-Semite, and, you know, Salvador Dali, you know, the great surrealist painter, supported the fascist Franco. I mean, so, you know, it's not like 100%, but it's about 90%. I mean, most of the people that have been involved in the arts over the last 300 years from the great social issues that roil us then and through today have always been, you know, what we would call today liberal or on the left.
Well, some of that stuff I heard you say, but again, I just want to make another just quick couple points.
Sure,
and
please.
I'll let you go. One being, I what you said about Rush. I listened to him, and I think he did shoot himself in the foot.
Mm-hmm.
Does he deserve compassion? No. I mean, he made a mistake. At least he admitted to it. But let's not forget too long ago, and I believe it was the 80s, 90s, with Marion Barry in Washington, D.C., when he was busted for cocaine, and everybody seemed to forgive him and gave him another shot at being mayor.
Well, I don't know that I did. Listen, there's a whole different deal. Like I said, I don't think that, I think all drug laws ought to be repealed. 100%, all of them. I think if people want to smoke crack and they're that dumb and they've been given all the information about how dangerous that is and how bad addiction is and what ill effects it'll have on your health, I think the government ought to get off people's back and let them be the sole determinant factor in whether or not, or what they choose, what poison they choose to become intoxicated intoxicated with. You know, most we can get, you know, we can drink our brains out to the fact where we have tens of millions of alcoholics in this country. That's just fine. That's good for the economy. Someone wants to do some alternate, some outlaw form of intoxication. Well, they're terrible. I mean, what I would like to see, I'd like to see Rush Limbaugh get hauled into court, sentenced to a couple years in jail, enter the prison, spend about a month and a half there, and then all of a sudden all the drug laws in America get repealed.
Right.
All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. I got to do a break and right back to get your calls. And what we're talking about, if you're just joining us, I got upbraided by Joel, who said that by me calling Rush Limbaugh, saying things like, why do you think they call him Rush? And pillhead Limbaugh and a pill-popping addict, that that I was hurting the cause of recovery. Now, our last caller, in kind of just in passing, said that he at least admitted it. Well, he admitted it because he didn't have any choice. He didn't admit it until it came out in the National Enquirer. Yeah, and that what that Bob Rivers song said, he's trying to keep his butt out of jail.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more calls right after this.
This is another Riff Rock concert.
You don't know Linkin Park until you've seen them live.
Live.
Linkin Park. Live in Texas. Their new CD and DVD in stores now. And see them live January 27th at the Palace. Linkin Park with special guest. P.O.D. Stank and Story of the Year.
Till the day I die.
January 27th, live at the Palace. Get your tickets on sale now at cc.com, palacenet.com, the Palace box office, Ticketmaster outlets, or charge at 248-645-6666.
For more, go to LincolnPark.com.
Men, how do you like to last even longer in the bedroom? Now you can with Maxtral, the new climax control system for men. Maxtral lets you last longer than you ever thought possible, so you can prolong the pleasure and maximize the control. Maxtral is scientifically formulated to give you the kind of stamina you want and a woman never forgets. Maxtral is for men of all ages. It's available without a prescription, and it can give you more satisfaction than ever before. Now you can make the pleasure go on and on with Maxtral, maximum control for men. Ask your doctor about Maxtral or call now and try Maxtral risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708. Prolong the pleasure, maximize the control, and see how much longer you last with Maxtral. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708.
Last year, we went overboard with our holiday spending and then struggled to pay that high-interest credit card debt. This year, the holidays are a whole lot better because I heard Ray Vinson on the radio and called American Equity Mortgage. Now we're enjoying the holidays free from money worries. Thanks, Ray.
You're welcome, Kevin. Hi, this is Ray Vinson, founder of American Equity Mortgage. I've got a message for you homeowners who are spending like crazy and running up those high-interest credit card balances. Now, before all your holiday bills hit, let's take a time out and give yourself a well-deserved nice present. Call American Equity Mortgage for a low-interest loan that's just right for you. You'll start saving big money right away, and you'll really enjoy your holidays. Call American Equity Mortgage now while rates are still low, before your holiday bills hit. Call American Equity Mortgage now at 888-229-7699. Before your holiday bills hit, call American Equity Mortgage at 888-229-7699. 888-229-7699. Open till 8.
Are you suffering from reoccurring minor aches and pains? Do you have arthritis or an old injury that flares up from time to time? Now there's an inexpensive natural solution available to curb these aches and pains. The Grabber Mycole Adhesive Body Warmer. Portable, convenient, air-activated, these little heating pads provide over 12 hours of soothing relief from sore muscles, aching backs, and arthritis pain. 12 hours! Find the Grabber Mycole Adhesive Body Warmer in the pain relief aisle at your local Meijer stores or visit warmers.com to find other local retailers. Looking for pain relief? With Adhesive Body Warmer, you're getting warmer.
Hunting, fishing, camping, skiing, snowmobiling. You look forward to your favorite winter activities, but sometimes the cold drives you back inside. It's time to get warmer with Grabber My Cold Warmers. Grabber's line of air-activated hand, toe, body, and foot warmers keep you warm and toasty for hours. They conveniently fit in pockets, bags, or glove compartments, so you'll always be ready to battle the cold. Grabber My Cold Warmers. Get warmer. Available at Cabela's, Sport Mart, Dunham's, Dick's Sporting Goods, Sports Authority, MC Sports, REI, Target, and Meijer, or visit warmers.com to find other local retailers.
Musicians, this weekend is the single largest guitar savings event of the year. The one event you can't afford to miss. Save 50, 60, 78% off and more on truckloads of guitars. Electric, acoustic, bassist, 4-string, 5-string, 6, 7, and 12-string. Every shape, every neck, every finish. Everything for guitar players. It's Guitar Center's 27th annual 3-day guitar-a-thon. Every top manufacturer, Fender, Gibson, Martin, Yamaha, Ibanez, PRS. Once a year, guitar-a-thon savings. Like Takamine Acoustics, over 60% off. Guitarathon price, $149. 10 sets of GHS string, only $19. Plus, get 4 effects pedals for just $59. And get this, score a complete electric guitar pack from Fender or BC Rich. Everything to start playing guitar in one box. Guitar, amp, gig bank, strap, and more, all for just $199. Guitar Center's 27th annual Guitarathon. 3 days only. The best guitars, the biggest savings. Don't miss it.
You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show with Peter Werby. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. If you're on hold trying to get on the show, please stand by. If the lines are busy, please try again.
Thank you very much. Squeezed out by the corporate-owned media, it's kind of hard to get dissenting views on. Both our phone screener and producer, Rick Fox, and I always get a kick out of the fact that people seem so stunned that there's anybody on the public airwaves with politics to the left of Mussolini. Well, there's lots of us. There's tens of millions, but you'd never really know that from the presentation on essentially the medium. Yeah, we're kind of back to that in a way, although there's certainly a lot coming out challenging the Bush policies. Tonight was sort of a special night. The group MoveOn.org, that is organizing against the Bush illegitimate presidency, presented a film, a video nationwide called Uncovered, The Whole Truth About the Iraq War. Now, this was shown in thousands of homes and churches and union halls and other locations like that around the country. And there were quite a few of them in the Detroit area. And I was at work while they were being shown. They were all shown, I think it was like 7 o'clock tonight. Like I say, you know, thousands of venues around the country. You can go to MoveOn.org and check this out. And it the best thing about it was that it overcame this passivity that people get when they just sit like a veg and watch television, particularly when they, you know, they're watching like useless news sources like Fox News. That's simply a propaganda arm for the Republican Party. And so people met. Like, for instance, I know there was a church in Ferndale, 100 people were signed up. What the people did, you actually registered. And, you know, people had them at their homes, so they'd have 15 people, 30 people. And this was sort of, what do they call it? It was sort of a multi-venue town meeting. So if any of you took part in these, I'd like to hear from you as well. All right, we're talking about language. Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts said about George Bush, did I expect George Bush to F up Iraq as badly as he did? I don't think anybody did. So the White House is all upset because he used language like that. Eminem is in trouble because he talked about wishing that there was a dead president. And I was taken to task because I was referring to Rush Limbaugh, that stoned out hypocrite, for calling him Pillhead Limbaugh and stuff like that. And our correspondent Joel said that I was hurting the cause of recovery. So we're talking about language to some extent, but you can bring up other things as well. Let's go back to our phones. 313-298-WRIF and call talkyes at yahoo.com if you are far away or prefer to communicate like that. Hi, it's Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
I think Rush Limbaugh is an insult to the rehab community. He seems to have tripped over the fourth step, which is humility.
Really?
He hasn't taken any steps to, apologize, atone, and make amends to people that he's insulted or hurt and is acting out behavior from his addiction.
That's interesting. Expand on that a little, because I'm not sure. Tell us about the steps and how that figures into it and what people frequently do in those programs.
I'm not that familiar with it either, but I do know that the first step is humility, and he's never been a humble person.
No.
And I do know that, people I know who have gone through 12-step programs, one of the things that they're required to do or one of the things that they're asked to do, in order to truly deal with their addiction, is to go out and, you're an alcoholic, you get drunk, you insult people, you borrow their money and, go get drunk and refuse to pay it back, all this stuff. You have to atone and apologize to them. That also comes from humility, that humility of saying, I'm facing something bigger than I am, and,
mm-hmm.
and acting out against it, I've insulted and hurt people.
You know what's always so curious to me is that the man is such a braggart, when he says, that I'm doing what God gave me, the brains to do, and I've, he's always touting himself, even excellence in broadcasting and all that. And only, here are these Republicans and conservatives that pride themselves on being independent and strong and masculine. And here's this guy that simply is asking them to be ditto heads. Can you imagine me or anybody to the left of center having people that would call themselves ditto heads or that would sit by and let a liberal or progressive or left talk show host saying, essentially, I am the best person in the world and the smartest in the country. I mean, people on the left would puke and turn off their radio.
Well, that's true, and also you'd end up forming sects and you'd end up in sectarian arguments like the left did in the 60s.
Yeah, I thought you said sex, but it's sect.
Sect, S-E-C-T.
Got it.
Not S-E-X.
Thank you. I appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Hi, it's Night Call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hello, Peter. How are you doing?
Doing good.
Okay. Now, I want to make a point about Rush Limbaugh here. Now, if he wasn't somebody special, for instance, or on the air, or somebody noticed, would anybody care that he was doing any kind of drugs or anything else in particular?
Well, the prosecutors might. I mean, they regularly prosecute people involved in...
Correct.
Yeah.
You're absolutely correct. But nobody would really care.
Right.
He's being not so responsible as in doing the drugs, but he's being responsible as in waking up for work every day, doing what his normal life is. If nobody was to pry into his business, nobody would know. Nobody has known for the last how many years that he's been on any
right.
kind of drugs whatsoever.
Right. Right.
Now, if you take, for instance, who's that guy that Playboy?
The what?
Well, anyways, remember when that happened with Clinton and one of the politicians came after him saying that if anybody has any evidence whatsoever on such and such, and then the guy that owns Playboy, I can't think of his name, he came out and said, I'll give a reward to anybody that has anything against any politician.
Mm-hmm.
You see how fast everybody backed down.
Well, wait. Let's go back to the Rush Limbaugh before we, get too far afield. Yeah, I agree with you that Rush Limbaugh has a medical problem and perhaps an emotional problem as well, since he seems to be taking anti-anxiety drugs and what have you. And we should have great sympathy for that, great compassion for that. One of the reasons that, in my book, he doesn't qualify for it is that he doesn't have any compassion for anyone else, and he has mocked people with the same affliction that he has, and has advocated harsh penalties for people violating drug laws. I don't think Rush Limbaugh has done anything to hurt anyone other than himself. Maybe some people around him. I don't know. Oftentimes addiction is harmful to other people. In general, if there's not a, the kind of situation where people are forced into crime to get intoxicants that whose prices are way inflated because they're illegal, they usually are just hurting themselves. So, I'd like to go back to the 19th century where you could smoke marijuana, where you could take heroin, use cocaine like, Sherlock Holmes was fictionally, and Rush Limbaugh would be treated in the manner that he should, not by the cops, but by his doctor and maybe a psychologist or whatever he chose to do and however he chose to deal with his own problems. But what we're dealing with here is a hypocrite of such immense proportion that people wind up when the mighty have fallen, where someone who says, I am doing, when he's broadcasting, what God gave me whatever to do, and you, lowly listener, he doesn't say lowly listener, are doing what God made you to do. In other words, listening to him. So a man with such arrogance and such hypocrisy, one can only laugh when he falls on his face.
So basically you're talking about every politician. Almost every politician.
Well, I won't argue too much with that. Rush is not a politician. He's a flack for the rich. He's essentially a media whore. He's in bed literally with the Bush family and the Republicans. He stays at the White House. I mean, how can a man have any credibility as a critical political observer when he sleeps with the political forces that he should be have a critical stance away from, so he can make judgments? I mean, I'll tell you, if I would have been given a night in the Lincoln bedroom while Clinton was in there, you know what would happen? Even though I was always critical of Clinton, I would think, well, you know, he's not such a bad guy, you know, and he's kind of a lot more like me, and an old rock and roller and all that. So, you lose your critical faculties once you start cozying up to power and wealth. Well, it turns out, of course, he has power in the ability to make his opinions known to his ditto heads, and he's turned out to be an extraordinarily wealthy man. But he's a miserable son of a bitch as well. I mean, he's addicted to this heroin like substance. He's taken two kinds of anti anxiety pills, and yet he's so greatly admired by all these people that call themselves by this absolutely demeaning label, ditto heads. Well, what?
All he is a voice. Everybody has their choice to listen to him and
right.
to follow his stride.
Right.
But, and now if he lived in Canada or somewhere else where a lot of drugs are legal, and a lot of people would overlook that. Now, the real problem is the doctors and everybody else and the insurance company, wherever he's getting the drugs through, that's their fault. Not necessarily his. Yes, he did have an addiction. But it is their fault because the doctors and all these prescriptions that were prescribed did not catch that.
Well, there's enough people prosecuted on that kind of stuff every year. And, there's a whole question, too. I mean, beyond getting pills. I mean, he's being investigated for money laundering, for getting other people to pay for his drugs. He's got, to feed his addiction. I mean, that's what addicts are forced into doing. I mean, we have crime based around drugs because they're illegal. And if people understood that, for one thing, there shouldn't be a shame to it. I mean, people get addicted for a whole complex of psychological and sometimes physical reasons. And rather than sending these people to jail, they ought to be sent to their doctor. And ultimately, anyone, whether it's a right-wing, big-mouth hypocrite, or, the mother next door who's taking mother's little helper, that they don't belong in jail. They don't, the resources of the police and the prosecutor's office and the courts and the jail shouldn't be involved in it at all. But Rush Limbaugh's a hypocrite, and he says that everybody that violates the drug laws ought to go to jail. So, Rush, bye-bye, baby. All right, thank you. Appreciate your call. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air.
Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
To hear you. You said most of the things I wanted to say about Russia. Thank you for getting to the part about, end this cruel criminalization of addiction. And certainly Rush Limbaugh is a hypocrite. I really hoped when this came public, that what a drug addict he was, that he would somewhere find within himself, maybe as a result of these experiences as being an addict, some kind of compassion for the other people. Now he's just like it. He doesn't want to admit it, but he's just like millions of other. The scum of the earth, the dregs of society, as far as he's concerned. A lot of us and our friends, Americans all, who've had addiction problems, and this son of a bitch will not come out now and say, hey, I'm going to use my bully pulpit to end this, because I can see it's wrong, because I can see not hurting anyone else but myself, and that should be my own right.
Well, he's figuring, just like this representative, was it Janlow, that killed this guy while driving 71 miles an hour through a stop street in South Dakota, that he's a rich Republican. The laws don't apply to them.
He doesn't go to a nasty place for rehab or barely any facilities. He's got some plush place. He's got a fancy mouthpiece lawyer that's going to get him off. They're already trying to say that the trial against him is some kind of politically motivated thing.
Right.
If you or I had as many OxyContins and the other drugs he had, we'd be going to jail. No question about it.
Yeah. How could he take... The only thing I can't understand, I mean, most of the people that I knew that had that have had substance abuse problems, alcohol and drugs, were almost became non-functional. The fact that he obtained that we know of 2,000 pills.
Well, he's a very talented guy, and he managed to perform while he was wasted. Maybe that's where some of his megalomania came from. Being
well,
so
that could
high,
be.
He felt like God.
We know he lost his hearing because of it, but. I'll tell you. I mean, you've probably heard me say, oh, it's a war on drugs. I can't even drive on drugs. All right. Thanks a lot.
Good night.
Appreciate it. All right. Well, let me see. What does Paulie say? He wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, I take issue with the caller who said that at least Rush Limbaugh admitted his mistakes. And Paulie says, it's pretty easy to admit doing something after you've been caught doing that thing. Yeah. He's just trying to keep his butt out of the slammer. And, by... going on the air and talking real personal and but like our last caller said, if he would have said, this has brought home to me the absolute foolishness, and this war on drugs is a war against the American people that has wasted probably $1 trillion. This war on drugs, which has never been won, which is created, or one of the bases, the financial bases of the prison industrial complex, that has brought untold misery to tens of millions of people, way beyond the misery caused by drugs or individual drug addiction. Because you got to remember, it's only a minority of people that use illegal substances that are actually addicted. For one thing, nobody's addicted to, in any physical sense, to marijuana. And people don't kill them, you can't hurt yourself with marijuana and all that. So all these people that have served time, what's done to their lives, what it's done to their families' lives, and are we any closer to eradicating drugs? And does the country really, well, not the country, but the people behind the war on drugs, particularly the Bush character, the Bushco, that realize what a vested interest so many groups and corporations and even the different, like the, where they have these prison guards that are wave always for real high penalties for drug use, that it's a scam, that it's a war against the American people. And rather than Rush Limbaugh saying, man, this finally opened up to me, that I finally admit, do you realize what he would have done if he would have got on the air and said, I've just been a hypocrite, that this all opened my eyes to what a fool I've been? Yeah. I don't think we're going to get that, though.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more calls right after this.
Every kiss begins with K.
I remember the first big snow last year. The kids' overwhelming excitement, everyone scurrying around to bundle up and get the sleds out. When we were all set, the kids hollered for Mom, but she was nowhere to be found. Then I looked out the window, and there she was, on the ground, making the most perfect snow angel. Just seeing her giggling and acting like a kid made me fall for her all over again.
What one gift can celebrate your past, present, and future together?
A 3-stone diamond necklace from Kay Jewelers would be a good start. Choose round, teardrop, or princess cut diamonds. Priced from $199.99 and presented in a free photo frame gift box. With a 3-stone diamond necklace from Kay, you can be assured of two things. First, that every Kay diamond is hand-selected for exceptional beauty. And second, that she'll absolutely love it.
Even without the snow, she's still a perfect angel.
Every kiss begins with
Shop K Jewelers, 13 convenient locations. Free financing for 1 year available. Minimum purchase and minimum monthly payment required.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine Online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants.
Like La Scala, located in the heart of Windsor's famous Little Italy district. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine Online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Buddy's Pizza, recognized is one of the nation's 5 best pizza places by the Food Network.
Log on today and save
with the home of rock and roll at WRIF.com.
Do you feel like half the man you used to be? Do you feel tired and irritable? Are you losing your sex drive? If so, you could have low testosterone.
I'm Dr. Richard Cohen, MD, men's health specialist. Testosterone levels can fall rapidly after age 35, but now you can boost your testosterone naturally. Introducing Testostazine, the powerful new testosterone-boosting system I developed for men who are starting to feel their age. Testostazine supports your body's ability to produce testosterone the way you did when you were younger, so you can restore your energy, youthful sex drive, and staying power. Testosterone keeps a man energetic and sexually confident. You can feel that way no matter what your age. Testostazine can help.
Call now for your risk-free confidential trial of testosterone. Call 1-800-807-8108, 1-800-807-8108. Guaranteed to work for you or your money back. Call 1-800-807-8108. Results will vary.
AirTran Airways in Flint asks you,
with or without
the kids,
nonstop flights to Fort Lauderdale for you and Orlando for the kids. Or the kid in you.
So, after you take the kids to see Mickey and the gang on AirTran Airways' flight to Orlando, spend your day sunning yourself on 23 miles of beach, having quiet nights on the waterfront, shopping, choosing from over 3,500 restaurants, sightseeing, or golfing their 56 courses.
Immerse yourself in Fort Lauderdale.
Spend time with friends, family, or enjoy solitude at sunset. AirTran Airways. Go. There's nothing stopping you. With nonstops from Flint to Atlanta, Orlando, and Fort Lauderdale, to make your low-fare reservation to any of AirTran Airways' 45 destinations, including Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Denver. Go to airtran.com. Call your local travel agent or 1-800-AIRTRAN. Flint's Bishop International Airport, where I-75 and I-69 meet. You can get there from here.
You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show with Peter Werby. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. If you're on hold trying to get on the show, please stand by. If the lines are busy, please try again.
Thank you very much. WRIF Detroit, our official designation to make us legal here. You go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com. Have a new one on Wednesday. This one is just too hard to navigate. A lot of Mac users can't get on. 1 o'clock Eastern time. That's in an hour. We're going to be, what should I put forth first? All right, we'll do Stephen Prothero. He wrote a book called American Jesus, How the Son of God Became an American Icon. He's a, he's the dean of the Department of Religion at Boston University. You think, wow, what's an atheist doing interviewing a guy like that? You'll see. And then Derek Jensen, who's an incredible writer with a book called Strangely Like War about the assault on the world's forest. Doesn't sound good, but we'll hear from him. All right, we're talking about language. Representative John Kerry of Massachusetts saying that, let me get the right words here. Did I expect George Bush to F everything up in Iraq as badly as he did? I don't think anybody did. And the White House said that there should be an apology. Of course, George Bush used language like that a lot. Eminem the Secret Service is after him because he said, in a song, I'd rather see the president dead. That's not good to say. He might be in a world of trouble, and me, I'm in trouble with Joel, who said that because I'm always mocking that hypocrite Rush Limbaugh, who, after criticizing so many people addicted to drugs and calling for harsh penalties for anyone who breaks the drug laws, now expects our sympathy. I say the hell with him. Then abolish all of the drug laws. All right, just one thing. I'll get back to our calls in a minute. This is absolutely extraordinary. We just had one of the warmongers, Rumsfeld, the Secretary of War, over in Iraq. Another one of those secret visits because they can't announce him, right? Because the situation is so unstable there. Tough new tactics by U.S. tighten grip on Iraqi towns. And this is absolutely amazing. The Americans embarked on their Get Tough strategy in early November. And this is from Abu Hishma, Iraq. It's a town there. And it's completely wrapped in barbed wire. All the residents have to have these ID cards that are printed in English. And you can't move in or out unless you have these identification cards. 81 American soldiers killed by hostile fire in November. Things are just going swimmingly, aren't they? I mean, people that support the war, doesn't this have any impact on you? That every day I'm just looking at Yahoo News and there's another soldier dead, two wounded. And what that means, usually face gone, guts gone, legs gone. I don't know. People support our troops. I mean, yeah, let's get them out of harm's way. Why the hell did George Bush send them in there in the first place, based on his damn lies, right? Anyways, the response that the Americans chose is beginning to echo the Israeli counterinsurgency campaign in the occupied territories. You know, this is where the Israelis have killed 300 or 400 children, have done some really evil deeds, like throw rocks at tanks, or very frequently just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time when they take one of our U.S. taxpayer-provided fighter jets and bomb some urban area and kill a bunch of kids as well, like just happened in Afghanistan where 9 children were killed. And now, these Afghans are just totally pissed off at us and probably going to send more of them over to the Taliban. Now, the Iraqis, he says, if you have one of these cards, you can come and go. That's Lieutenant Colonel Nathan Sassaman, the battalion commander, whose men oversee the village. So, it's this occupied town. The Iraqis nodded and edged their cars through this line over to the side. An Iraqi man named Tariq muttered in anger, I see no difference between us and the Palestinians. And some of these quotes are absolutely astounding. Brigadier General Michael A. Vane wrote, experience continues to teach us many lessons, and we continue to evaluate and address those lessons. For example, we recently traveled to Israel to glean lessons learned from their counter-terrorist operations in urban areas, which means use F-16 fighter jets in urban areas to pinpoint kill a suspected Hamas leader. No trial or anything, it's just an assassination. This, by the way, besides being against international law, is also what the Israelis are doing, is also against U.S. law that forbids the internal use of military aid for the suppression of people within one's own country. Of course, that's not their country, is it? It's occupied territories. Now, listen to Captain Todd Brown, a commander with the 4th Infantry Division, as he stood outside the gates of Abu Hishma. You have to understand the Arab mind. You have to understand the Arab mind. Now, old Captain Todd Brown has been in Iraq how long? And he understands the Arab mind. Here's what he says. The only thing they understand is force. Force, pride, and saving face. Now, these are the people we went over to save from this grisly dictator. I know we're supposed to forget that all the stuff about weapons of mass destruction was a lie and that Bush's father and Ronald Reagan were responsible for supporting Saddam Hussein, providing him with weapons of mass destruction and all of that, winking at his use of them against his own people and all that. I can't imagine anything more a more repellent and racist statement than you have to understand the Arab mind. And you think, well, why? Aren't they this undifferentiated mass? aren't they people with no individual identity, either as single people or, you know, classes, ethnicity, nationality, anything? No, there's an Arab mind, as seen by Captain Todd Brown, a company commander with the 4th Infantry Division. Here's what he says. The only thing they understand is force. Force, pride, and saving face. These are the people that we've come to save. The people that the only thing they understand is force. Can you imagine an Iraqi that was in the United States that said, you have to understand the white mind or the American mind. You have to let's just leave it like that. You have to understand the white mind. The only thing they understand is money. Money, football, and shopping. Remember some dismal character wrote us last week and said, American people are happy. They're all out shopping. Actually, middle-class shopping is down. Wealthy shopping is up, by the way. And poor and working class, down. Bad down. So this is what he says. You have to understand the Arab mind. The only thing they understand is force. So these are the people we've come to save. And Colonel Sassaman himself says, with a heavy dose of fear and violence and lots of money for projects, I think we can convince these people that we're here to help them. I mean, did they really say this? These are people whose country George Bush illegally invaded, sent our men and women over there to make these vile racist statements and to say, with this arrogance born only of an imperial invader and occupier, that with a heavy dose of fear and violence and a lot of money for projects, I think we can convince these people that we're here to help them. Can you imagine being occupied by someone? Some country? Can you imagine the Chinese coming over here, occupying America, and saying the American mind, the only thing they understand is, and coming across with that, and saying the only thing we understand is a heavy dose of fear and violence, but we're going to convince them. These are the Chinese occupiers here in Michigan. They're going to say that these people, that we're here to help them. They have a barbed wire fence, razor wire all around the place. Here's what everything is a lie. This fence is here for your protection, reads the sign posted in front of the barbed wire fence. Do not approach or try to cross or you will be shot. Well, wait a minute. I thought it was there for your own protection. But if you try to cross it, you're going to be shot. Well, I'll tell you, folks, we're just making so many more enemies there, and it's going to come home here. We just have been lucky since September 11th. These people in Washington are going to be the death of more of us. They've already responsible for the deaths of hundreds of us and the injury of thousands of us. So you say, oh, well, you know, what the hell? The hell with those Iraqis. You know, they're going to do it our way. And ultimately, we're going to be safer. Well, no. Here's another article. U.S. commander in Iraq expects attacks to increase. So we're going to treat these people in the manner that the Israelis treat the Palestinians, who are hated. The Israelis are hated so profoundly by the Palestinians, and we're picking up their tactics because these are the people that we are going to help and save, and we're going to create this democracy for them. We're going to have a democracy like ours, right, where elections are an auction, and the president's dad stole the election for his kid. It's all just a disaster. All right, that's what I think. I'd like to hear from you, too. And, oh, yeah, we're talking about Rush. You know why they call him Rush? Because he had 2,000 OxyContins plus Xanax and some other stuff between March and September. Now, rock star Ozzy Osbourne says he was wiped out on prescription medications when he gave his stupefied performances on reality television and in public. The only thing was, let me see, he was... Whereas he was wiped out on pills, Osbourne said. I couldn't talk. I couldn't walk. I could barely stand up. I was lumbering about like the Hunchback of Notre Dame. Well, how the hell did Rush Limbaugh manage to do that? He wipes out his hearing. He's so overdosing on OxyContin. Yet he's going, you know, maybe, I don't know. Actually, I don't have any maybes. I don't know what to say. 313-298-WRIF, calltalkyes at yahoo.com. This is Night Call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
How you doing?
Doing good.
Well, I've been listening to your show. I just had a comment to make about a couple of the statements you had made about the drug issue.
Sure.
You had said about how the government should, you know, get uninvolved in the...
Are you with me? No? All right. Sorry. WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Oh, Peter?
Yeah, hi. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about two things. One was the Move On event that happened tonight, and the other thing is a project that the Green Party's working on.
All right, let me
billboards.
Good.
In the city.
I just want to tell people again, in case you just joined.
Sure.
MoveOn.org had nationwide screenings of a video called, I have it right here, Uncovered, The Whole Truth About the Iraq War. You can go to MoveOn.org, or you can go to my website and find out more information. So there was a number of them here in Detroit. Which one did you go to?
I went to the one at the Detroit Art Space, which was down by Grand Boulevard and Woodward. And it was quite interesting, actually, because there was about 100 people there. And there's apparently about almost 3,000 of these showings that happened today.
Right across the country.
Right across country, right. And there were about a half a dozen in the Detroit area. And so there were about 100 people there, and so they showed this this film about how Bush had lied to us about Iraq, and it was very informative. A lot of people from ex-CIA people and so on who were in the film, and people who you wouldn't expect to be critical of the government, and it was a very convincing film. And one of the more interesting things was that after the film was over, that there was a little discussion group that went on for about an hour or so, where people began to focus a little bit on the media and how the media had really misled a lot of people. And so you have about half of the people who think that in the country who think that Iraq is somehow related to the 9/11 incident. And so the media is, works hand in glove with the government in terms of almost like a propaganda arm to persuade people to support the war.
Mm-hmm.
And the people at this showing were very sensitive to that, and they said that they felt a little isolated themselves, but it was nice to be in a crowd of people where everybody sort of understood the dynamic and they didn't feel quite alone.
Yeah, well, they feel isolated because they watch the corporate and right-wing media. I never watch that stuff, and I don't feel isolated. What I do is, and if you're going to tell me about, and we'll get to that in a second, about the Green Party and its billboard, you have a alternate community other than the media to relate to, and that's the deal. I mean, I get people that have that know George Bush is a liar and a fake, and they say everyone thinks he's great. Well, it's the opposite. Where I go, nobody thinks he's great. And one other thing, there's a lot of MoveOn.org showings of the Iraq film Uncovered that weren't even counted, because I know at least two people that had showings at their homes and they weren't listed in the official 3,000. So there's probably a lot more.
Uh-huh. Well, one of the other interesting things about this Move On phenomenon was that this was something that was organized totally over the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really an inexpensive way of bypassing what is a very expensive media campaign. In other words, they didn't have to go to radio and television and advertise that they were going to have these showings and so on. They did this strictly over the internet, which cost very little money, and which gets into the whole question of how do people who oppose the policies of the government communicate with each other. And you can do it, by sending emails and forwarding articles and things like that, but that doesn't always get to sort of like the general population of the guy, going off to work in the morning.
Sure.
And I think that ordinary people who aren't into or attuned to things like the Move On campaign need to understand that there's another reality out there, that in fact everybody isn't supporting the war. Even people who are in the military and families of people who are in the military are opposed to the war, and the media doesn't talk about that very much. It doesn't let people know that there's a significant portion of the society that wants the troops to come home right now.
I wonder,
wants the war ended.
Yeah, I would bet. I don't know if I can find this. You can go to accuracy.org, and there'll be a description there of these military families who have sons and daughters, in one case, a woman with a son and a daughter, who are currently over in Baghdad, they are opposed to the war. They want their kids home. They want all the kids home, and they're invisible to the media. By the way, I just found this, too. A growing number of Americans, 70%, don't think the war in Iraq has reduced the threat of terrorism, according to USA Today. Well, hello. It's probably increased it. All right. One of the ways that people on the way to work could, how's this for a lead-in, would see dissenting opinions would be to see billboards that talk about bringing the troops home now. So why don't you speak to that a little?
Well, one of the things that I'm a member of the Detroit Green Party, and we've been sort of tossing this around a little bit about how do we, present this alternative point of view out there, given the overwhelming presence of Fox News and things like that. And so one of the things we decided to do is to try and put up some billboards around the city. And these billboards, some of them are actually quite expensive, like a billboard on I-94 and I-75 intersection costs about $5,000 a month to have one of these giant billboards. But there are other smaller billboards that are seen by a lot of people, and you can get these billboards for a much cheaper price. And so one of the things we've been trying to do is we've decided to organize a billboard project, and we got a local artist, Tana Moore is her name, who put together a billboard, a graphic with the word oil with a blood drop coming from it, and a sign that says, as a part of that same sign, it says, "Bring the troops home now." And
yeah.
So what we're trying to do is get this billboard out there, or a series of billboards, and we're asking people to help us by contributing some money to this billboard project. And if people want to do that, they can go to our website where they can donate online. And our website is DetroitGreens.org, or they can write us a check and put it in the mail.
Well, I think people are probably going to want to look at it first, but it's a good. It's also on my website at PeterWerby.com.
Yes, we appreciate that, by the way.
Yeah.
But if they go to DetroitGreens.org or to your website, they can see what the billboard looks like, and there's also information there on the address to send us a check.
Well, I just wanted to say that.
Help us.
Yeah, well, keep up the good work, and I look forward to seeing those billboards up in Detroit. Thank
Very
you.
Good.
Appreciate your call.
Okay.
All right, thanks a lot. All righty, moving on. And see, you know, we're not powerless. We're powerless if we sit in front of that television and soak up the lies of the corporate and right-wing media. But when we get together with people, and wherever you are, wherever you are, there is someone who agrees with you. And in many cases, there's hundreds. I mean, I'm lucky. Many of you are listening in small towns across America on the Internet. And you're thinking, and you may be, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, maybe in some small town you are the only person that thinks like that. But yeah, I bet you even that's not the case. In any event, we're fortunate to live here in an area of the country that's predominantly tolerant and progressive and generous and opposes war and supports women's rights and workers' rights. And you get, these, there's this loud minority would sometimes, and because they have incredible access to the media, whereas the majority of us don't, that you sometimes think that they're the predominant political force in this area. Well, just look at if you want to look at voting stats. Yeah, these conservatives are a minority. They're a vast minority, in fact. They just got the money, so they get the loudest voice. All right, let's continue on. I'm Peter Werby. This is the Night Call Show on WRIF. And our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. And let's see. Hi. It's Night Call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Yeah, hi, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Hey, I grew up in West Detroit in the 70s. My father was a union plumber. He did the original work in the Renton.
Really?
My brother is a local 98, 98 is the plumbers union. My brother is in the electric union.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in a union household, and I believe I'm a Republican, even though I'm a union member. And I believe the Bush tax cuts are helping us. I think it helped my household.
How could it help your household?
Well, I received the tax rebate check, and it helped us.
Well, but that it wasn't really a rebate. It's not like you got any more money that wouldn't have been coming to you anyways. It just got to you a little early.
Well, it came back to me, though. I mean, if it wasn't for the tax cut, it wasn't going to come back to me.
Here's the deal, though. If you were supposed to get a $1,000 rebate, you only get a $700. Essentially, that advanced you the money. The tax rate for anybody, if you're a union plumber?
No, my father is.
Okay. Well, whatever, or your father. What he got was something that he would have gotten anyways. It just came at him earlier. And the middle class, which union wages have put him into, rather than having a free market of labor, which we'd all be working at Indonesian pay scales, union labor and wages have allowed you to be a middle class family, but he's not seeing any substantial amount more in his check. I mean, he might be getting like $200 more a year. He might be paying $200 a year less in taxes. This was a giveaway to the ultra wealthy. So the Bush government has expanded extraordinarily government expenditures. So, I mean, you have the per capita, this enormous amount, more than any amount per capita since World War II. And like World War II, it's not going into services for us, not a national health program or creating beautiful cities or, you know, fixing our roads and putting in bridges and having, you know, ferries across every body of water and a wonderful train and transportation system or anything like that. It's going to Bush's buddies that destroyed Iraq, and now it's going to Bush's buddies that are rebuilding Iraq. So it's a monstrous racket that's operating on your family's income. And secondly, since you're a young person and Bush has driven this nation into debt and does things like for political purpose, I mean, almost everything is, for instance, this Medicare scam that just gives, that gives away the store to insurance companies and health insurers, you're going to wind up paying for it. I mean, we're a debtor nation. Every penny we spend, all this looting that's taking place by Bush's pals to rebuild Iraq, you're going to pay for it with interest.
My father and older brother rode the waves up and down with the economy and the unions here in Detroit on building the city. And all I hear from them is that from the job site that the support is high with the union members for Bush in the city of Detroit, with the economy and the infrastructure that's going on in the city.
I doubt it. I mean, anybody, any union man that supports the Republicans, they got their heads screwed on upside down. I mean, everything that Bush is doing is an attacking on working class and working class standards and living standards. I mean, it's the idea that that the average working man can actually live a middle class existence, or union woman, is going away. You know, I mean, jobs, there's still this bleeding of industrial jobs, the jobs that it's the weakest recovery in 60 years. The jobs that are being created as we continue to lose industrial jobs, they're at these low-wage service sector positions, and Bush has this intense hostility to unions. So if a union guy backs the Republicans, let alone Bush, he's doing the work of the fat cats. Now, the wealthy, there's not enough of them actually to create a majority, so they have to, through smoke and mirrors, create the sense that they're going to do something for the average person. But they're not. I mean, the economy is not good. It's still weak. Transferring this billions of dollars to the ultra wealthy with the expectation that they're going to invest it is just nuts. I mean, there are sectors that are, you know, can, I mean, people still build stuff and what have you. But, I mean, if you wanted to go with somebody, you know, on their history of job creation, that would be Clinton. I mean, Bush has lost under him. 3 million jobs have been lost, and this 150,000 or so that were created, for one thing, is below what he predicted would come about because of his job recovery. And you got to remember, too, the average working person is his and her productivity has expanded greatly. So they don't even need as many workers, and it's not like they're going to reward people that are working for their increased productivity. Their idea is increase productivity, drive wages down. Now, why the hell would any middle class or working class person support Bush with policies like that?
Well, I think currently here in Detroit, for example, union members are making a decent wage currently today, and there is enough work to keep them going with their kids, casinos, and what have you. To accept the fact that we'll accept this current government. And I think they support Bush because they feel he's strong in terrorism and kind of a kick-ass atmosphere. But at the same time, I guess I agree with you, the fact that he's truly not supportive of unions or labor establishments, and nor do I think the Democrats are. I don't think out of the two parties, neither of them really support the common middle class person. I think they both smoke up us.
Well, I'm no fan of the Democratic Party. Don't get that idea. But when you talk about union people supporting Bush, I think it's, you know, somewhere around 30%. The vast majority of union households, you know, vote Democrat.
Well, I think that could wager up and down when it comes to whether or not he's going to support steel tariffs or any other legislative type of decisions could up or down the percentage of the so-called union vote.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that most unionists see, as I said, see Bush as extraordinarily hostile towards their interests, and I have never seen such. I mean, I'll use the word, the H word, hatred towards you know, someone occupying the White House. Well, give me your last thought. I got to move on. Well, let's just say goodbye then.
Right.
Appreciate your call. Thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. Now, what commies said this? Oh, this is the Bloomberg letter, Bloomberg.com. You know, the guy that's Republican mayor of New York City. Let's see. Shouldn't those of us who comment on the economy be willing to put aside the last 2 years? You know, this is where there's millions of jobs have been lost in the private sector since January 20th, 2001. And simply celebrate a job gain of 126,000. I mean, you can see what lackeys, what media whores the television and the newspapers are when they talk about the economy is booming and things are going great in Iraq. You know, it's like whistling in the dark. One would hope it would be so. At least they do. Shouldn't we celebrate a job gain of 126,000 as a sign that the U.S. job machine is humming again? Now, this is Bloomberg. This isn't any, you know, radicals or anything. One problem, they say. While an addition of 126,000 jobs is better than a loss, it represents anemic job growth for any month during an economic recovery. Indeed, it would have been the fifth worst month of job growth in the 48 months of President Bill Clinton's first term. So, too much to, and this is young people particularly, all of us should be concerned, but young people are going to be the ones who are paying off the debt that the Bush gang is running up. Looting the future, says Paul Krugman, or Krugman, I don't know, everybody says it differently. Paul, K-R-U-G-M-A-N. And Let's see. Recent good economic news doesn't change the verdict. These aren't temporary measures aimed at getting the economy back on its feet. They're permanent drains on the economy. He's talking about nothing in our national experience prepared us for the spectacle of a government launching a war, increasing farm subsidies, and establishing an expensive new Medicare entitlement, and not only failing to come up with a plan to pay for all this spending in the face of budget deficits, but cutting taxes at the same time. So, what's going to happen is you folks, you know, that are, say, under 30 are going to wind up paying for all of this. That rather than your taxes coming back to you in the form of government goods and services, this is all going to pay off interest to foreign banks that are loaning the United States money in order to operate. And he says, to be fair, the looting is partly bipartisan affair. More than a few Democrats threw their support behind the Medicare bill, the energy bill, or both. But the Bush administration and the Republican leadership in Congress are leading the looting party. What are they thinking, says this man who's a professor at Princeton of economics. Lawrence Michel, who is the president of the Economic Policy Institute, says the number of new jobs is far below the administration's promises of 306,000 new jobs each month as a result of the recent tax cuts. The plan the president declared a success is now 1.25 million jobs short of administration projections of jobs that would be created through the so-called Jobs and Growth Plan implemented in June. Just another lie. An absolute another lie in an administration that is marked by lying. This is from Bill in Seattle. He's listening at WRIF.com, so he's listening to us streaming live. Reality bites, he says, as he wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. The rich get rich and the poor stay crushed at the bottom. This is Bush's America. I read somewhere that a group of conservative zealots, that's all they are, want to, Bill, want to remove Roosevelt's image from the dime and replace it with Reagan's drooling mug. Symbolically, I think this says it all. Bury one of the great Democratic presidents and liberal thinkers and replace him with a puppet buffoon of the corporate elite. Again, we welcome to Bush's America. Maybe Nancy's astrologer can help us see the results of the 2004 election so we can all plan on whether to stay in the U.S. or get the hell out of Dodge before the goose steppers come a-calling. If you think that's too extreme, remember Tommy Franks, General Tommy Franks, said if there's another major terrorist attack, the experiment, as he called it, with constitutional government could be ended. Well, Bill, have no fear. Nancy Reagan opposes replacing FDR with Reagan on dimes. She said, when our country chooses to honor a great president such as Franklin Roosevelt by placing his likeness on our currency, it would be wrong to remove him and replace him with another. It's my hope that the proposed legislation will be withdrawn. Now, this is called, I mean, these are the Republican morons in Congress. Mark Sauter, Republican of Indiana, introduced the Ronald Reagan Dime Act. I mean, you know, act means for a statute. I mean, I like that, though. The Ronald Reagan Dime Act, in response to a TV movie, depicting a doddering Reagan dominated by his wife. Well, gee, they sure hated to have the truth presented there, didn't they? All right, let's continue onward. A couple more emails, but I want to get your calls on the air as well. We're going to line three. Thank you, Rick Fox. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
It's great to talk to you. There aren't many voices like you out there nowadays. It's kind of depressing sometimes.
Yeah.
I really am concerned about what's going to happen next year. And I voted for Nader in 2000, and I've been dealing with whether or not I should feel guilty about it, but I've come to terms with that, and I'm trying to figure out what I can do for next year, and I'm trying to you know, keep my ideals as close to the Green Party, because I agree with them very much in a lot of cases, but I think regime change in 2004 is job one.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to go out and support the candidate that I think is really has a chance.
Who's that?
You know, it looks like Howard Dean right now.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
For a number of reasons, beyond like the way he's raising funds,
mm-hmm.
and you know, he's got hundreds of thousands of people getting together money for him instead of taking money from, you know, big, you know, corporate lobbyists or, you know, corporate interests and you know,
right.
Very
well,
rich people.
Let me go back to something you said about, you said that getting rid of Bush is job one. I feel a little uncomfortable kind of putting these in a, you know, ranking that. I mean, I certainly think it's extraordinarily important to rid this country of this illegitimate presidency. The guy that lost in 2002 yet is carrying out this right-wing revolution to the detriment of almost everyone in the country.
Yeah.
I mean, some of these people are too dumb to see that it's actually affecting them negatively as well, but whatever. But I never, you know, elections in many ways are pretty passive affairs. I mean, people are called out to, you know, come at a particular day, at a particular time, at a particular place to plunk their ballot down and go home, and they think then they've discharged their duty of citizenship. Well, we see that usually about half the people, even in major races, stay home, sometimes as many as 80% in smaller races. So one of the things that's occurred in this country is that public life has been decimated by things like television, by, you know, purposely by making the streets inhospitable to the kind of rich cultural street life that you see in Europe. In fact, in most places in the world other than the United States. So, to me, it's not like getting rid of Bush is number one and attending a MoveOn.org showing of, you know, of an Iraq video is number two. In fact, I don't know what I'm saying. I'm contradicting myself. I was going to say the opposite is true. Getting people together in public spaces
is job one.
Providing a sense of reality that we're not this isolated minority, but probably, as we did in the 2000 election, represented the majority of people that did not believe George Bush was a moderate or that he was a uniter or anything like that. And to reestablish ourselves in a sense of collective self-confidence, and doing that by public meetings and demonstrations, by supporting unionization efforts, since these people that are trying to unionize at borders. And I mean, here's this little strike out in Ann Arbor, yet it's beginning to energize not only the labor movement in Detroit, but everyone who's concerned about the low level of wages in America and what how this is going to become the service economy with people making crappy, unlivable wages.
Yeah, it scares me.
So social activism and social interaction seems to me to be job number one. And then people will go, oh, yeah, election day, I better go get rid of that SOB Bush before he destroys more of the gains that Americans have made over the last couple hundred years.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, and that's one of the things that actually excited me about Howard Dean's campaign is through, like, I'm sure you're familiar with the meetup and all the things going on through his website, and there's a vast grassroots movement. I mean, I haven't done any sort of research into comparing sizes of movements on that grassroots level, but people are getting together and making friendships through that, and I think that's pretty exciting. It doesn't present any reason to endorse a party for the rest of your life or anything like that, or I obviously don't agree with everything he's saying and think that he's going to solve all of our problems. He doesn't seem to be even saying that he is going to solve all of our problems. He's going to try to do his best, and I think that he has the best chance is what I'm trying to say.
Well, there isn't
a big organization right now.
I know. I mean, I have little, or to be quite blunt, have little or no confidence that any of these guys are going to do anything too much different off of, certainly off of Bush, but in terms of what's gone before him. But I think it's important that Bush does not receive a second term. I mean, I don't know what to do. I mean, he stole one election. Now they've got all these these touch screen ballot things that are controlled by these Republican operatives. It's very scary.
Yeah, the quote that he's going to do what he can to see Bush reelected is creepy. I mean,
people should
be up in the arms about that, I think.
Yeah, that's the CEO of this Diebold company. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me. If you don't know what the hell I'm talking about, there's something called black box voting. And if you go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, you can see it all. Now, Kenny is listening in Garnett, Kansas at WRIF.com. I keep getting emails from people, including Ben Birch, who is the webmaster of WhiteRoseSociety.org. That's where you can go to my site, or you can just go directly to WhiteRose.org, and you can log onto the archives of this show. Anyways, I'm sorry if this isn't all coming across. In fact, Ben, I was going to just write you this. Why don't you write the WRIF engineers? Maybe you can just write me, and I'll send it on to him, because I don't know how the hell to tell you to write the engineers here. But I know this streaming isn't going too well tonight. Anyway, here's what Kenny writes from Garnett, Kansas. Remember that kid that was on, the 13-year-old kid last week, was saying that George W. Bush was his hero? Well, this is what Kenny is commenting on. And he kept saying to me, I was saying that this trip to Iraq was just this phony deal, this PR. It wasn't aimed at the soldiers. It was aimed at the American people, trying to get his ratings up. And Kenny says, unfortunately, this kid needs to get a reality check. He wanted to know what Bush should have done on Thanksgiving instead of going to Iraq for his photo op. And Kenny says, well, maybe Bush should have went to Bethesda Medical Center and thanked our soldiers who have given parts of their body for this war. Or maybe he could have called the families of the dead soldiers and expressed his gratitude for their sacrifice. He could have gone to the Vietnam Memorial and thanked the names of the soldiers who didn't receive the sweetheart deal of serving in the National Guard like Bush did when he decided to show up. which wasn't frequently. That's why there's awalbush.com. Those are just a few of the things he could have done but didn't, says Kenny. This kid needs to realize that this war is not a video game where you get maimed or die. When you get maimed or die, you're magically brought back to full health or life. Yeah. And Rob from Dearborn writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, apparently the turkey photo op on Thanksgiving was more of a show than we thought. The bird that Georgie was famously shown carving with great care for our boys over there was a plant supplied by a caterer for the cameras, and the 600 sleepy troops were fed cafeteria style from tubs of pre-cooked sliced turkey. Georgie boy and his sweet band of cutthroats strike again. Keep taking a slice out of those overstuffed Republicans, Peter. I will, Rob. And, yeah, remember that? You know, so it's all a scam. And this is another, you know, the people that are feeding them, all of a sudden it's right out of my, what is it, Kellogg Root Brown. That's right. They've got the contract. They're a subsidiary of Halliburton. That's the company that Cheney is still getting money from. It's a racket, folks. And we're paying the cost. All right, let's continue on. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening. Yep, nobody there. All right, where are we going next? Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air.
Hi, Pete.
Hi.
Hi, this is Howard from Grass Lake again.
Hi.
Yeah, you're talking about the Bush cutthroats there. Did you check out the Nick Smith debacle there last week on the vote for the Medicare bill?
Say that one again. What?
Nick Smith, our representative here in Jackson.
Yeah?
Yeah, he got some heavy pressure. They told him his kid who's running for a seat, when he retires next year, they told him his kid was going to be dead meat if he didn't vote for that bill.
And isn't this that they're doing an investigation? They offered, on the other hand, they offered him $100,000 if the Republican Nick Smith would vote for the Medicare bill, right?
Absolutely. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well.
So that's their own boys. You know, that shows you how much they love themselves.
They are so thoroughly corrupt.
Absolutely.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
All right, now there's supposed to be an investigation of that. Of course, you have this corrupt character, this authoritarian Cotton Mather in the Attorney General's office. Remember the loser? Remember all that? You know, John Ashcroft, you know, all of a sudden it's kind of become this institution like J. Edgar Hoover, sort of cut out of the same cloth. And it was Ashcroft who lost to a dead man. He didn't want to be the Attorney General. He wanted to be the senator from Missouri. So he was running against this Mel Canrahan. What was his name? Canrahan? I can't remember now. Carahan. Canrahan, I think. In any event, he lost to him. That the people of Missouri said, we can't handle this guy. Voted him out of, wouldn't put him into the senator's seat. So they made him the Attorney General. Yike. All right, our next caller is right here. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Yeah, how you doing? I got to be honest with you. It's nice listening to you, but on the average, I don't agree with most of anything you say. But I got to say, I do agree with one aspect about the Bush administration not visiting the troops
mm-hmm.
who were injured in combat. I will agree with you on that one.
You know why do you think he won't?
I'm not exactly sure, and I think it's a horrible PR move in his case, and it also makes the Republican Party look bad.
Well, here's what I think, and I'll let you finish. I think that they don't want to draw attention to how many American soldiers are so terribly maimed for life. Is that that way every president, including Bush's dad, went and met those returning planes with the bodies of American soldiers, but they want to keep this fiction that everything's just going swimmingly while we're losing our people daily. Go ahead.
One thing I got to say on that, though, I was in the United States military for 8.5 years during the Clinton administration, and I agree that the economy is bad at this time, and there's certain things Bush could be doing to get it better, but the same aspect, Clinton, when I look at it this way, if you don't pay your bills for 8 years, and all of a sudden you have a lot of money in the bank, but all of a sudden, after 8 years, they're going to come after you. The problem with the Clinton administration, in my opinion, was, and seeing this myself firsthand, the military and the intelligence operations area, was that the cutbacks were so drastic across the board to get for the military, the DIA, the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, so on and so forth, that put us in such a far hole and put us so behind the power curve. When September 11th happened, the reason it happened, because we had holes in the system. And the Clinton administration, one thing I say about Democrats, they think about the here and now, not later down the road. and you got to think of the big picture sometimes.
I almost think it's the other way around. I mean, could creating this enormous deficit be thinking about further down the road?
Yeah, but at the same time, this deficit is created because of the CUP Act that the Clinton administration did across the board with the Armed Forces and Intelligence Agency for almost 8 years.
Well, wait a minute. You can't create an enormous deficit by, if you're even correct, of shortchanging a few departments. I mean, we're not talking about hundreds of billions of dollars.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly true. But the same aspect, when we were put behind the power curve for 8 years, now it's catching up with us. I'm not saying there's not better things the administration could do. I mean, I am a Republican. I think there are some faults he's making. And I don't think he's a hero, let me say that first of all. I think we could have a better president, of course, Reagan. But I know what you're going to say about Reagan. That's a different story. But overall, I think that the aspect is when it comes to foreign affairs, it's a very tricky issue and a very tricky subject. And the problem is, for 8 years, Clinton didn't deal with the foreign issues as the aspect. He dealt with the handshakes, nice smiles, get the job done at the moment, but didn't think in the long term. For example, Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda operatives had almost, six attacks on American troops and personnel over the eight-year period that Clinton was in administration, did nothing about it. He bombed Afghanistan once or twice, that was about it.
On the other hand, here we had Bush invade Afghanistan, kill thousands of innocent Afghan citizens, we're still over there. And, you say some American flyer killed 9 children today. And, if you think about that, and having been in the military, I mean, how would you like that on your hands? And, this guy didn't go over there and say, hey, there's some kids, let's kill them. He was over there because he was sent over there, and now we have this whole village that is just boiling with hatred for Americans. This isn't over there. This big success, this easy little jaunt through, through Afghanistan to get rid of these quarreling warlords, this could still wind up to be a dramatic defeat for the United States.
Yeah, but the same aspect, what are we supposed to do? I mean, the biggest thing the Democratic Party right now is talking pull out. And right now, we're so far deep, we're so much into this operation that if we pull up now, what do we say for the 160, 170 personnel that died so far after the actual war in Iraq ended?
Well, I think when someone like myself or anybody else says that we ought to withdraw our troops, is that what should have been done in the first place is not this violation of international law by this unilateral invasion based on this complete lie. Bush, remember, said that there was this threat of an imminent attack. That's why we had to violate all these international law. And that Bush has the United States acting as an imperial occupier rather than having this something that would be spread out through countries of the world that wouldn't create this incredible intense resentment that's building. Building. I mean, here you got this American commander right here. U.S. commander in Iraq expects attacks to increase. And the more we hit them, we're just almost playing into their hands. And you could say, well, what else are they supposed to do? Our troops are sitting ducks. Well, it's circular. And it means, it has Vietnam written all over it. Okay. All right. I got to go anyways. Thank you very much. One more call. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air.
Yes, I was just commenting about the president's visit to Iraq.
Sure.
I agree that he should have went, but I disagree he didn't go to Afghanistan. He's also, and I agree with you also when you said he is reluctant to visit the injured and the killed.
For
the same reasons you agreed.
Uh-huh.
But I disagree with this being another Vietnam. It doesn't have the same aspects of the Vietnam War did in the sense that they brought in the UN in a lot more instances than they ever did in Vietnam. And I also kind of agree with you as far as the way they're fighting. If I look at it this way, Hussein knew he would never be able to take the U.S. on one-to-one.
Right.
So he's only employing the tactic he knows he can win at because he's going to build it. He's working on your willingness not to stick the fight out.
Well, why did Bush pick the fight in the first place? He said he had to pick this fight because the United States and countries in the region were at risk from imminent attack by Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. Well, I knew there were none. I knew that Bush was lying. I knew that Colin Powell lied in front of the United Nations and the whole world. So he picked a fight that when there was none that needed to be picked. So why did he do it? Because he had such compassion for the Iraqi people. Well, no, because he wanted to establish an imperial outpost there that would secure the oil reserves of that region for the United States and its, well, not even its allies, and also from the, you know, the core of Bush's you know, political power, and that's you know, the oil companies. So this was a dastardly deed, and of course Bush, like everything else in his life, when he ruins a country, I'm sorry, when he ruins a company, you know, when he, you know, is able to scam out of the draft, he just walks away with no problems, and the ordinary, you know, working class kid, man and woman, winds up dead in a ditch from somebody in a village who's beginning to hate us more and more with each passing day. So I think that the United States ought to, that Bush ought to admit abject failure. Nothing happened like he said. There was no weapons of mass destruction. The people didn't greet us as liberators. The United States is increasing its heavy-handed occupation tactics, which is only going to lead to more attacks on us and more hatred towards us. And if we're lucky, I mean, imagine having to say this, if we're lucky, those attacks will remain in Iraq. But I wouldn't depend on luck, and those attacks may visit us here at home. As they say, they're looking to the Israeli model as how to suppress counterinsurgency with these counterinsurgency tactics of the Israelis. One can only shudder at what we think the tactics of the other side could be. All right, thank you very much. I got to go home. Oh, we'll do a few interviews. So thank you for listening and thank you for calling, and we'll do this part of the show again next week.
Are you suffering from reoccurring minor aches and pains? Do you have arthritis or an old injury that flares up from time to time? Now there's an inexpensive natural solution available to curb these aches and pains. The Grabber Mycol Adhesive Body Warmer. Portable, convenient, air-activated, these little heating pads provide over 12 hours of soothing relief from sore muscles, aching backs, and arthritis pain. 12 hours! Find the Grabber Mycol Adhesive Body Warmer in the pain relief aisle at your local Meijer stores or visit warmers.com to find other local retailers. Looking for pain relief? With Adhesive Body Warmer, you're getting warmer.
Hunting, fishing, camping, skiing, snowmobiling, you look forward to your favorite winter activities, but sometimes the cold drives you back inside. It's time to get warmer with Grabber My Cold Warmers. Grabber's line of air-activated hand, toe, body, and foot warmers keep you warm and toasty for hours. They conveniently fit in pockets, bags, or glove compartments, so you'll always be ready to battle the cold. Grabber My Cold Warmers. Get warmer. Available at Cabela's, Sport Mart, Dunham's, Dick's Sporting Goods, Sports Authority, MC Sports, REI, Target, and Meijer, or visit warmers.com to find other local retailers.
Get ready to feel it.
It's the wildest vibe on the east side at Wild Woodies in Roseville.
Get into a bikini day as the Wildest Woodies and 101 WRIF present
the finals of the Miss Hawaiian Tropic Swimwear Competition.
Join the Riffs and Carlini as the most beautiful women in the Motor City compete for the Miss Hawaiian Tropic Championship, along with cash and prizes this Wednesday night.
Think you've got what it takes to take a walk on the wild side? Then let's get this party started at Wild Woodies this Wednesday night.
Want to play?
Hook up with killer prizes courtesy of Wild Woodies in the Red. Enjoy the usual wild Wednesday night debauchery with 101 WRIF.
Then feast your eyes on the creme de la creme with the finals of the Miss Hawaiian Tropic Swimwear Competition.
Stay late and join the Metro's most beautiful people for the hottest Wednesday night dance party around.
Check out the wildest wait staff in town, and everyone can cash in on $1.50 bottles of beer all night long. The search comes to an end.
The Miss Hawaiian Tropic Swimwear Competition.
Don't miss the finals this Wednesday night at Wild Woodies. Woodies in Roseville.
Wild Woodies.
Wild Woodies, just minutes off I-94 on Gratiot between 13 and 14 Mile in downtown Roseville. Wild Woodies.
Coming December 12th to the State Theater. The return of Typo Negative and their Morbid Metal Mayhem. They're back and better than ever. More doom, more gloom, and more of the sheer sonic brutality you demand. See Typo Negative and Cradle of Filth with special guests Moonspell. Tickets on sale now for this all-ages show. On December 12th, the State Theater will witness the fire and brimstone that is Cradle of Filth. Blacker than black and louder than hell, Cradle of Filth will pulverize you into submission. Don't miss Cradle of Filth appearing with Typo Negative and Moonspell at Detroit State Theater December 12th. Tickets on sale now. The State Theater is located at 1211 Woodward Avenue in downtown Detroit. Buy your tickets at cc.com, all Ticketmaster outlets, Rock of Ages, Record Time, Hot Hits, or charge by phone at 248-645-6666.
Professional teeth whitening doesn't need to be like this.
Yeah, all right, now open your mouth just a little wider.
I can't make it any wider.
A little wider.
It's just wider than
it
opened
my
mouth.
Just a second.
Oh, what are you doing with that?
Yeah, almost finished. Now I just need to do a little polishing.
Oh, my God, stop.
Very good. Very good. Now this is just going to rinse it all away.
Wait a second.
There you go. Yeah, that wasn't so bad, was it?
Whitening your teeth is now as easy as a trip to the spa. The new Sparkles one-hour teeth whitening facility in downtown Birmingham is simple and quick. You don't even need an appointment. Just stop in and you'll be out in about an hour with bright white teeth. Sparkles is the pinnacle of teeth whitening technology. So before you waste time and money on expensive over-the-counter products that will only deliver poor results, call Sparkles at 1-877-SPARKLES. Get the stunning white smile you've always wanted at Sparkles. 1-877-SPARKLES. Because everyone loves a bright white smile.
Every kiss begins with K.
I remember the first big snow last year. The kids' overwhelming excitement, everyone scurrying around to bundle up and get the sleds out. When we were all set, the kids hollered for Mom, but she was nowhere to be found. Then I looked out the window, and there she was, on the ground, making the most perfect snow angel. Just seeing her giggling and acting like a kid made me fall for her all over again.
This time of year, what gift will touch her heart? The Leo Diamond. The first diamond to be independently measured and certified for superior fire, sparkle, and brilliance. Each one is handcrafted, reflecting the passion and skill of four generations of master artisans at Leo Schachter. Set in rings, pendants, or earrings, the Leo is priced from $599.99 to $7,000. At K Jewelers, your authorized Leo Diamond Jeweler.
Even without the snow, she's still a perfect angel.
Every kiss begins with K.
Shop K Jewelers, 13 convenient locations. Free financing for 1 year available. Minimum purchase and minimum monthly payment required.
Have you ever had a bad experience at the dentist? A lot of people are afraid of the dentist. Others just don't have the time. Then when they finally do go, there's a lot of work to be done, and it makes them even more afraid or embarrassed. Hi, I'm Dr. Abe Krishanowitz. With Sedation Dentistry, we can make it easier for you to have years' worth of damage repaired in just a few visits. It is simple. Regardless of how many years of neglect you've been through because of fear or lack of time, we will help you achieve healthy teeth and gums for a lifetime. You put off going to the dentist long enough. Don't wait any longer. What I'd like you to do right now is call 586-247-0010. That's 586-247-0010. Or visit us on the web at mydentistry.com. We've changed people's lives. We can do the same for you. No matter how long you've waited because of fear or lack of time, we will help you. You thought about doing it. This is your opportunity. Call now, 586-247-0010, and receive your initial exam and x-rays for only $19.
Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby, on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Good morning. Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you, as usual. As if you've been listening to this broadcast, you know I'm not a particularly religious person, but a lot of it has been hitting me, Religious America, and partly I just finished Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Code, and I just saw it today in the New York Times, a comparison between our country, the United States, and our friends about 9 miles south of here in Windsor, Canada. How much different their religious attitudes are. And we'll get into that in a little while. Right now, though, I'd like to bring to our microphones Stephen Prothero, and he is the author of a brand new book. It's called American Jesus, How the Son of God Became a National Icon. And Stephen Prothero is the chair of the Department of Religion at Boston University. Stephen, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, what a wide subject. I mean, everybody would think this is pretty simple in terms of Jesus. We know who Jesus is. He's the Son of God. He redeemed man for his evil nature. Yet, American Jesus, and talk about the Son of God being a national icon. Jesus is supposed to be kind of universal, isn't he?
Sure he is, but, you know, he's a different universal person to just about everybody, particularly in this country. So there's different views about him depending on what race you are, depending on what religion you are. There's people inside and outside Christianity who think all sorts of different things about Jesus.
Well, I mean, it's hard and almost to get a grasp on this conversation. Well, tell us about the American Jesus. How does he different from, say, the Jesus in Latin America?
Well, for one thing, he's incredibly important here. The United States is the most Christianized country in the world, and so it's not surprising that as a culture, as a nation, we take Jesus really seriously. So that's probably the most important distinction, is that we really care about this guy. But the other is that we have really made him very familiar, that it's very typically American to make Jesus a friend, somebody who you know and understand and you love and loves you, as opposed to seeing him as really high up there, very different from human beings and lording over us.
Well, is that because of Protestantism? I mean, Catholics need more of an intermediary and a process, whereas a lot of people say that they know Jesus, that he speaks to them in their daily lives, that they pray directly to him without any intermediary.
That's right. It's the influence of Protestantism, but it, more specifically, I think, it's the influence of evangelicalism, which was so important in the 19th century, this kind of Bible-believing, born-again style of Christianity. And it's those folks who really crafted this Jesus loves me, this I know type of person who's really near and dear to them and a friend and close to their hearts.
Now, you mentioned that the United States being the most religious country in the world, more so than the Catholic countries of Latin America, for instance, or Italy?
Well, I mean, in terms of numbers, if you just add up 80-85% of the population of the United States is Christian, and then you multiply that times the population, that's a lot of people, and it's more than any other country in the world. That's right.
Well, as the chair of the Boston University Department of Religion, Stephen Prothero, do you count yourself in that 85% of Christians?
I get asked that all the time by my students. I guess I do. I'm kind of a confused Christian, more confused than others. That's probably why I like to study this stuff, but I was raised in the Episcopal Church, and I attend irregularly but frequently a Lutheran church.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm kind of on the opposite end of that. I guess I'm in that 15%. I don't consider myself religious or Christian or a believer.
Uh-huh.
Yet I suspect that someone immediately when they hear you, they would suspect that you're also socially and politically liberal, because there's sort of an invariance that about religion and God and the nature of God and Jesus and religion among conservatives. So, and when you say you're a little, you know, ambivalent or confused about religion, it often doesn't play well with people that are, you know, that see religion and particularly Christianity as having a very important role in their life and the life of the country.
Yeah. Well, actually, most of the believers in my book who I write about are, I think I would call conservatives. Conservatives don't have any opposition to innovating when it comes to religion, and they do it all the time. That's one reason why born-again Christianity, for example, is so successful in the United States, and Mormonism is so successful, because they are willing to adapt to changing times and even adapt their understandings of Jesus to them. I've had the book read by a lot of evangelicals and born-again Christians, and they all like the book. They understand that there's a lot of Jesus out there in American culture, and the issue for them is, let's get out our message so people accept the right one rather than the wrong one.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's Reverend Al Sharpton that says we're not interested in the Christian right, we're interested in right Christians.
That's right.
You mentioned the 19th century, and there's this American particularism. Every other Western industrial country sees its religiosity dropping. I think, I don't know if you saw that article in the New York Times today, but I thought I had the figures. So, yeah, 68% of people in Canada say you don't have to believe in God to be a good person. Only 40% in the U.S. do.
Right.
Well, I mean, and we're, you know, here in Detroit, we're a stone's throw away from our Canadian friends and listeners. What's the difference just with the border?
Well, the First Amendment is a huge difference. We've had a free market in religion from the very beginning, and that's created all kinds of religious options for people. And they, in the United States, they typically can find one that shakes right for them. Also, the malleability of Jesus in American culture is something that drives our spirituality and religiosity. We've got all these different understandings of him, and everybody can look around and grasp onto one that works for them. So it's unlike countries, especially in Europe, that have had state religions where there was really one religious choice, and it was, you know, that way or the highway. In the United States, we've always had, from the very beginning, or at least since the First Amendment in the 1790s, we've had many options for many different sorts of people.
Now, actually, the country has become more religious since its origins. We talk about this, or some people do, I don't, talk about this being founded as a Christian nation, yet many of the founding fathers were pretty far from the formal kind of Christianity that we think of dominating American religious life today. Am I accurate in that?
That's totally right, and I write a good bit about Thomas Jefferson and how he's been claimed by all sorts of people for themselves, and other founding fathers who were really clearly deists have been claimed as Christians unfairly, I think. But if you look at a lot of these folks, particularly Jefferson, he clearly was a Jesus lover. He loved Jesus. He thought Jesus was the greatest philosopher of all time, not unlike President Bush. He thought Jesus was terrific. It was Christianity that he didn't like. And that's not at all uncommon among political folks, particularly early in the American experiment.
You talk about in your book, Stephen Prothero, American Jesus, How the Son of God Became a National Icon, about Jefferson taking a razor to a Bible. Is this actually what he did?
Yes, he did. He as he read the Bible, he read the verses that he thought were really the words of Jesus, and then the verses that he knew were later interpolations by as he called them, fake Christians. And he went through, over the course of a few evenings in the White House, he went through a couple Bibles and cut out the pieces that he thought were legitimate, authentic, pasted them in a big folio, and that became the Jefferson Bible, and everything else fell onto the floor.
Does it still exist? I mean, can one read that as a religious document?
Not his first version of it. It's been lost, but a later version that he did actually is in the Library of Congress, and the book you can still buy in bookstores. It's called The Jefferson Bible.
Really? Huh. That's interesting. It, to some extent, reminds me of that very popular book that I just finished, Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, where he talks, the novel does, about the certain books of the Bible. There is what they call the Apocrypha, right? The books that just didn't make it into the approved Bible, that some of the stories of which seemed kind of wacky, early life of Jesus, some of it which portrayed him more as human than divine. How does one sort out, or is that part of the American experience, as you indicated about Jefferson? I mean, what's real and what isn't? A lot of this stuff was written, 100 years after the life of the historical Jesus.
Right. Well, that's part of the fun of debating Christianity and debating Jesus, is figuring out which of these texts are legitimate and which aren't. In the case of the Da Vinci Code, I think it's telling how big this book is. A lot of people are saying they're so surprised by it that it's taken off, but I think it's another example of a best-selling Jesus novel. We have lots of novels in U.S. history that are about Jesus. And the Da Vinci Code also taps into this very Jeffersonian split between Jesus and the church, and folks who love Jesus but hate the church, like Jefferson did. And that's really the spirit of Dan Brown's book on the Da Vinci Code, that it's the church that's wrong. Churchianity is what's gotten us into trouble, and if we could heed the authentic words of Jesus, we'd be a lot better off.
Mm-hmm. Now, my wife asked me, she said, well, what's the book about? And I said, essentially, it's anti-Christian and pro-Christ.
Right.
I didn't want to give away too much of it. You think that that's
I think that's absolutely right, and the only distinction I make there is I'd say it's anti-Christian or anti-church and pro-Jesus, making a distinction between Jesus and Christ, because Christ is a word that has theology in it, that mm-hmm. Jesus was the Messiah, and Jesus is just a personal name. And my book focuses on this guy without assuming any particular theology about him, and that's why I call him Jesus rather than Christ.
Well, now, only, as I said earlier, according to this New York Times poll, 40% of the people in the U.S. think that you have to believe in God in order to be a good person, I guess to have somewhere where your ethics and values are rooted. As you're indicating, this whole concept of Jesus is kind of slippery. It kind of all befuddles me.
Well, religions need to be ambiguous to get along in the world. The world changes in pretty drastic ways, and any religion that's around for 1,000, 2,000, 4,000, or 5,000 years has to have some slipperiness in it, and that may be uncomfortable to some religious people, but I think most religious people understand that you need to adapt a religion just like you need to adapt any other form of culture. And so you can say it's troubling that you get so many Jesuses over time, you know, the Jesus of the Ku Klux Klan or the Jesus of the Civil Rights Movement or the Jesus of the feminists or the Jesus of the chauvinists. But another way of looking at it is that this is a way that, that the tradition adapts and is able to speak to different people in different times and different places.
My guest is Stephen Prothero. He's the author of American Jesus, How the Son of God Became a National Icon. I'm Peter Werbe, and we're talking about his book. Well, I mean, is Christianity or belief in Jesus a way that one can, you can see this is a question I'm thinking about, too. I'm kind of stumbling all over here trying to think how to pose this. I mean, can we root our ethics in this belief in Jesus is how it is almost individually interpreted when to me, looking at the world politically and socially, some of the most awful people in our culture adhere a strong belief in Christianity. And then as you were talking about the civil rights movement and today as well, some of the best people do. So you got, in my view, and I'm sure everybody would kind of come at it different ways, you got the worst and the best all saying, we're Christian. It goes back to Sharpton's thing about we're not interested in right Christians. We're interested in the Christian right. Well, they would see it the absolute opposite.
I think that's right. And I think it's very smart and important to say that religion is a great force for good and for evil. There's people who try to pretend just one side or the other. You know, Marxists who will say, oh, you know, religion is the worst force in the world. That may be true. And then Christians who want to say, oh, it's the best force. And that may be true as well. I happen to think that's right, that the best things in the world and the worst have all been done in the name of religion. You know, to what extent you can get up a real forceful political movement or a real forceful effort at economic social change with Jesus behind you, it seems odd that one could do that given how slippery this guy is, but the fact is that has happened. You know, that's what we did with abolitionism, that it was Jesus who was out in front and saying, look, this is what Jesus says in the Bible about this. We need to get rid of slavery. Martin Luther King standing up and saying, you know, this is what Jesus says. We need to get rid of segregation. And the same with temperance, or the same with, for and against World War I. So this has happened throughout American culture. It seems odd that you could appeal to this chameleonic type figure and really get people jazzed and mobile, but the fact is you can. And it's been going on for a very long time and will keep going on in the future.
Well, as an outsider to this, as I indicated earlier, as a non-believer and a non-religious person, it looks then sort of as a wash. I mean, if you've got, on one hand, abolitionists saying that the Bible says that all people should be free, we're all brothers and sisters, and on the other hand, you have the slave owners say that slavery is okayed by the Bible, and you can go through every social issue, even up to and including, as you said, questions of war and peace and unionism and what have you in the 1930s, contrary to what 60% of the Americans say, it doesn't seem to me like a place where one can really successfully root values and ethics any more than you could just by announcing a political stance.
Well, but that's just not true historically. I mean, the fact that people line up on both sides of the issue, I think that's a given. That's a given in politics, too, as well as in religion. Then the question is, who has the most forceful argument? Who has the most forceful appeal? And it turned out, when you take civil rights, for example, you know, there were some segregationists who appealed to Jesus for segregation, but their argument just wasn't forceful. You know, you look at the guy in the Bible, and you just don't see a segregationist. It's just not persuasive. So it might be to a very few people, but it's not to most. And King's vision of Jesus, also rooted in the Bible, was just more persuasive. So I don't know that it's all that different from politics. The fact that people are lined up on both sides doesn't trouble me. What's intriguing to me is to see how people marshal the authority of Jesus and how they use it quite successfully, and they have over time.
Well, your subtitle, How the Son of God Became a National Icon, in terms of kind of icon, I can't even say the big words, what's that word?
Iconography.
Iconographic. How would you say that one? Oh, well. See, I told you before the thing, who's going to make the mistake? So that sometimes guests say, what are we going to edit out of this? I should edit my stuff. The iconography, there you go, of Jesus. Tell us how it's changed. I know that tonight I can go through a neighborhood in Detroit where I can, the Shrine of the Black Madonna, and I can see Jesus portrayed as a dark-skinned man, almost an African-American. But when I arrive at the suburban YMCA where I'm going to play handball, I'll find a white hippie with blonde hair.
That's right.
So how does this all play out?
Yeah, well, I'm intrigued you mentioned the Shrine of the Black Madonna, because that actually starts off a chapter that I was working on that's called Black Moses. So there is a long tradition in American culture of the Black Moses, Jesus as an African-American. I think the part of the way he becomes iconic is that he can be represented to so many different people, where people can look at him as Madonna and Child and with African-American features and say yes, and other people can look at this sort of pretty wavy-haired image of Jesus that you can see either in his Beach Boy incarnation by Richard Hook or in his more 40s incarnation by Warner Solomon. Those kind of images you see often in Lutheran churches or evangelical churches. And they can say yes to him. And he becomes real to them through these pictures. So on the one level, you'd think the proliferation of images would kind of make any given one not make a lot of sense, but I think it actually works the other way, that the fact that there's so many different images out there, again, people gravitate toward one, and they say, yes, this particular picture makes a lot of sense to me.
Well, that gets back to what we're talking about, the interpretation and reinterpretation of Jesus in a particular time and what people, because, I mean, obviously, people... sure you've heard, people would say, well, gee, look, the real Jesus, given what we know about history and the time that he lived, he was probably between 5'2" and 5'4". He looked very dark and Semitic and probably had, dark curly hair. And that the reinvention of him is, some people say, inappropriate and opportunistic, but I suspect that's not the way you feel.
I don't think so. Americans have been doing this from the beginning. There's a great early documents that I found of purported description of Jesus. It's supposed to go back to some Roman soldier that saw Jesus, and there's this elaborate description of him with hazelnut hair, and this is how the chin hair was parted such and such a way in his beard. And Americans have been fascinated with this question for a long time. How does this guy look? And the latest is to say, yeah, he's Semitic. He was Jewish. Let's face up to that. I think that makes a lot of sense. I don't think he looks Hawaiian, as I've seen pictures of him. I don't think he looks Chinese, as I've seen pictures of him. He probably looked rather Jewish. But Christianity, and not just Christianity, but Jesus piety, invites people to imagine. And imagine what this guy looked like. I mean, after all, it probably doesn't matter a heck of a lot if you're a religious person or even if you're irreligious what the guy looked like. But the fact that he was a person invites you to imagine what sort of person he was. And the Bible doesn't tell you. So you can't say, well, this is wrong or this is right. But you can certainly look at some evidence from genetics and otherwise to imagine.
Now, the other thing I was thinking, and I was almost hesitant to bring this argument up given its origins, and maybe, well, I'll just do it without mentioning its origins, but the whole idea that of a Middle Eastern religion, essentially, inserting itself into Europe and then into North America and to this whole hemisphere is odd in that we, those of us that trace our roots back to Europe, we had this huge pagan religion of different forms, and in a sense didn't have to be quite imagined as much. We didn't have to kind of turn it around with different images and what have you.
Well, I don't know that that's true. I think forms of paganism have had their adaptations as well.
They must have.
Which rock do you want to worship, or which stream is more important than the other stream, where do the gods hang out closer to the earth? Those are the kinds of things I'm sure pagans debated. We just don't have access to the records the way we do with Christianity.
Mm-hmm. And also, you talk about in your book American Jesus how you mentioned about Jefferson's idea of Jesus. But then, and I was curious because I've just been able to kind of rather look at the book, what you call the feminized Christ of the Victorians and the manly redeemer of Teddy Roosevelt era. Now those eras aren't too far apart. I mean, could you give us an idea of how they both were presented and what brought about the change?
Yeah, well, I think that one of the claims is that Jesus does follow cultural trends as well as setting them, but he tends to follow more than set the trends. And so when you have, in the mid-19th century, you have a rise of influence of women in the churches, particularly in the Protestant churches, where as the free market of religion kicks in, preachers start to realize, hey, we need to preach to the women because they're the ones who are the vast majority of people in the churches. The men aren't as interested as the women. And they start to come up with these more feminized versions of Jesus, how he's this gentle guy and he puts children on his lap and he's portrayed as a baby with his mother. And you know, he's a loving, friendly person rather than this authoritarian guy up in the sky who's looking down at you and barking out orders. And that became very popular in the late 19th century, and you can be seen in lithographs and in novels and in the churches and out in popular culture as well. And then there was a reaction against that in the Teddy Roosevelt era, when you had these woodcuts in Harper's Magazine that showed football players with rippling muscles and soldiers and cowboys and Indians. And it was a real period where the machismo really was important, in part because of the Spanish-American War and Teddy Roosevelt's influence. And Jesus then, you know, lockstep, starts getting muscles and starts becoming much more macho. We need to appeal to our men, keep the men in the churches with these more masculine, muscular versions of Christianity. And so you get muscular Christianity, as we call it now, in the YMCAs, and Jesus who works out and is the carpenter with the big muscles. And this has happened throughout American history, this Jesus keeping up with these cultural trends.
Well, we're almost out of time, Stephen Prothero, and the religious imagery today that's projected from Washington. I mean, again, when you associate religion very heavily with a political view in the way that the Bush administration has, it certainly doesn't endear itself to me more. I mean, I would tend to look more at the peace and social justice activists that root their activities in Christianity. But sort of the official Christianity today looks like Jesus is a Republican.
Well, I think that's right, and I think that was part of Bush's strategy, you might say, when he was asked, you know, who's your favorite political philosopher, and he says Jesus, that he's letting people know that he sees this connection between born-again Christianity and the Republican Party, and it's something you see very clearly with Ashcroft and others, and of course that's troubling. There's a long debate in American culture about how close church and state should get to one another, whether this is a Christian nation. And my view in the book is that it's a Jesus nation, but that doesn't make it a Christian nation, because there's a lot of non-Christians, Buddhists, Hindus, Jews, Muslims, who think Jesus is a great guy and even in some sense worship him. So the fact that this country is so obsessed with Jesus and so intrigued by Jesus doesn't mean that it's a Christian country, and it certainly doesn't mean that right-wing Republicans should be running the show in the name of Jesus.
And this from Stephen Prothero, chair of the Department of Religion at Boston University. A lot more here to look at, folks. We've barely scratched the surface of American Jesus, how the Son of God became a national icon. Stephen Prothero, thanks for having joined me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for having me.
I have, and I share with many of you, hopefully with most of you, is a concern for our environment. And from time to time, it's good to get a look into what's going on in the natural world itself, the assault on it by human beings, and government policy, how that affects it all as well. And there's a very important book that's just come out. It's called Strangely Like War, The Global Assault on Forests, and it's co-written by Derek Jensen and George Draffen. And Derek Jensen is our guest, and Derek Jensen is the author of The Culture of Make-Believe, A Language Older Than Words, Listening to the Land, and co-author of Railroads and Clear Cuts. Derek Jensen, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thank you for having me.
And you're where? You're up in British Columbia.
No, actually, I'm in far northern California.
Okay.
I'm in Crescent City, which is on the coast and right on the border of Oregon. So I'm about 5 minutes from old-growth redwoods and 5 minutes from the ocean.
What does it look like there? Because every once in a while, I think, you know, if you didn't have the information like is presented in Strangely Like War that you co-authored, you could see grand forests and woods, and, you know, one goes hiking, and you know, it doesn't look so bad.
Well, two things about that. One is that, yes, there are places that are like that, but they're remnants. I mean, it's like 95% of the ancient forest on this continent is gone. And I don't remember the numbers exactly, but it's essentially like 90% of the native forest on the planet's gone, 80%. It's a large number. And in some countries, all of it's gone. And the forests that remain are, for the most part, pretty remote. I mean, I live in a county that for the United States is pretty remote. There's, I think, 15,000 people in the county, of whom 4,000 are prisoners at Pelican Bay State Prison. So there's 11,000 non-prisoners in this county. And so there is some forest that still remains here. And so, I mean, walking through those forests is an extraordinarily wonderful experience. And actually, it's all very problematical, too, because the other day, just maybe 2 weeks ago, I was out in the forest, and I went to this place called Mill Creek, and I saw about 15 coho salmon spawning. And I mean, it really brought tears to my eyes because it's so beautiful. And at the same time, it brought tears to my eyes because I've seen pictures and I've read accounts of what it was like prior to the arrival of our culture, where there would be, and the pictures I've seen are of Alaska now, where it's literally so thick that if you step in the water, you would step on a fish. And
wow.
I'm so excited to see 15 now. And that's sort of how I feel about all the forests, is that, you know, there still is this great beauty left, but it's pretty rare. And the other thing I want to say very quickly about that is that oftentimes people drive down roads and they can say, wow, there, you know, the forest looks really nice, but that's because there are these things called beauty strips, which are, they intentionally leave strips near roads so that you can't see the clear cuts.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just walk, you know, 200 yards or 50 yards even through that, you'll come out on the other side and see just a moonscape. And
well,
that's actually in Oregon, things have gotten so bad that they're now cutting the beauty strips.
Well, Derek Jensen, where I live in a big metropolitan area, the Detroit area, and you know, the small suburb. I live in a fairly small suburb, and you know, there's like four times as many people as in your whole county, and yet all I have to do is travel 20 minutes, and I go to what we call a metro park, and there's lots of big trees. They were planted in the 1920s as part of you know, the government forestation project, maybe the 1930s, probably part of that, all that. And, yeah, I mean, so we've cut down all the trees, people would say. So what? There's trees, there's birds are living in them. What's the problem here?
Well, one of the things that we need to remember is that forests, there's a difference between a bunch of trees standing somewhere and a functioning forest. That a forest is not just a group of trees. It's a collection of creatures living in relationship to each other, where they're actually benefiting each other. And so you can see a hillside. There are pretty famous pictures of, you know, a hillside of just monocrop of Douglas firs or something that have been planted out here. And that's essentially, I mean, even though it looks prettier, it's essentially like a cornfield. And from the perspective of anybody else living on the planet, then these, I mean, sure, we may walk into a bunch of trees and say, wow, this looks really pretty, and it sure will look pretty, but it's still not a forest. And the other thing to say about that is that there are no forests on the planet anywhere that have survived longer than three rotations. And what that means is if you cut the trees three times, then right now the Black Forest in Europe is dying in part because of acid rain, but also because it's on its third rotation. And you just keep taking the nutrients out, and you kill the soil. And when you kill the soil, it's all over. So those trees may be fine. Those trees may be fine, but it's not going to last.
Mm-hmm. Now, this all began a long time ago. Gilgamesh cut down the ancient cedar forest of Mesopotamia, and there's some Gilgamesh on my block as we speak, cutting down three 100-year-old oaks because they produce too many leaves. So tree cutting goes back pretty far into human history.
Well, it's really, you know, the Gilgamesh story is really the first written story of our culture, and it's a story of how he cut down. And we all see these pictures of what's going on over in Iraq now, and a lot of it. I mean, when I think of the sort of Middle East and then into the Near East, I always picture just these barren hillsides with maybe some scrub on it. But the truth is that much of the Arabian Peninsula was an oak forest, and much of what is now Iraq was filled with cedars so thick that the sunlight never touched the ground. And really, our culture, there's this line that forests precede us and deserts dog our heels. And you can see this all over the world. Not humans, because there were humans living in North America for thousands of years, at the very least, who didn't deforest. It's our particular way of life that has been deforesting civilization. You know, and there were lions in Greece. And there were, Aristotle was writing about how, about deforestation. And, I mean, it goes way back in our culture, and it's continuing with this imperative. And it's based on, a lot of it is based on this perception that you just mentioned a moment ago, that we can cut down trees and still have, you know, a living hillside.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really short-sighted, and by now, I mean, it's a short-sighted way of perceiving the world. And by now, we should know better. We have 6,000 years of history to look at. And who was it who defined insanity as doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result?
Well, I guess the only thing of what you said so far that I don't think is entirely responsive to what I was mm-hmm. presenting is that what are the consequences? I mean, we all live here on the planet. We got big cities. We've got, even if we got 5% of the old forest, you did talk about the problem of three plantings, but one, maybe, you know, we could stop after two. I mean, what... And if this has been going on for 2,000 or 3,000 years, it looks like it's sustainable.
Well, that was the point I was trying to make about the Middle East, is that it was at one point forested, and it's no longer forested. It's not coming back. And so it seems to me that what you're asking is, why should we care?
Right, exactly.
Well, one of the reasons is because of it's simply wrong to deforest, and it's simply wrong to drive salmon extinct. But if we're going to stay within the sort of utilitarian worldview, you know, salmon, for example, were a major, major economic resource. And, you know, the fisheries are gone now in the Pacific. The salmon fisheries are gone in the Pacific Northwest. And mm-hmm. that's a huge economic cost to the commercial fisheries, or commercial fishermen. And so on that level, that's something to care about. And global warming, I mean, of course, trees are a major sink or forests are a major sink for carbon. And that's, once again, but I'm a little bit hesitant to use, and then we've all heard the arguments, of course, about how, you know, cutting down the rainforest is killing all these medicinal plants that people can use to save themselves from this or that disease. And we can make those arguments, but I'm not really comfortable using them because they don't challenge the underlying utilitarian worldview, this underlying worldview that everything exists in the world for our use,
yeah.
which is just really nasty, for one thing. And the end point, and I've written about this in my book, The Culture of Make-Believe, I mean, the end point of utilitarian worldview really is assembly line mass murder, because if you perceive the world as to how you can use it, the world will congeal for you into four groups, and that's the people like you who are allowed to consume everything in their path. And the second group is those you want to exploit, and it's best if you can exploit them through... get them to exploit themselves through the rhetoric of production. You know, what's wrong with you? You're not productive. You know, why don't you get a job? Are you lazy?
Mm-hmm.
If that doesn't work, you point a gun at them. And the third group is those who resist, and those are, you need to kill them spectacularly to stop other people from resisting. And the fourth group is those who are simply extra. and that those are the ones who are on land that you know you could put to better use. And that was, you know, the Jews in World War II. That was the Slavs, the Russians. That's the Palestinians these days. That's the American Indians, the indigenous the world over. And that's almost all the natural world. Why are these trees on this land? You know, we could put this to economic use. And so my point is that, and the fourth group, the way you want to deal with them, if you're in this exploiting class, is you want to just get rid of them as quickly and easily as possible. And it's best if you can starve them or cut them down. I mean, I keep thinking about this line back from the Middle Ages about the Catholics killing heretics, which was kill them all and let God sort them out. And there's some arguments as to whether anybody actually said that. But
well, they said it in Vietnam as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the same thing with clear-cutting. You know, kill them all and let economics sort them out. And it's the same thing with factory fishing or factory trawling, that, you know, kill them all and let economics sort them out there too. And that's a really, I mean, once again, on a utilitarian basis, it's really, really stupid. I mean, the timber industries, on the national forest, the timber programs in the national forest cost the American public more than they get back, which means that the American public is actually paying to deforest.
Subsidizing these big logging firms.
Yeah.
And paper firms. Yeah.
And of course, you and I both know that capitalism is based on subsidies and it couldn't exist without subsidies. But
you mean Derek Jensen, you're trying to say that we don't live in a free market system?
Oh, there's this great line by Duane Andreas, who is the former head of Archer Daniels Midland. And he said, I'm going to butcher this line, but basically he said, there's not one grain of anything that's in the world that's sold on the free market. It exists only in economic textbooks and the speeches of politicians.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so my point is that it would be so cool, and this is never going to happen, but it would be so cool if they would just change the subsidies and even pay these nasty timber corporations to actually go in and reforest. It's all so silly. Oh, and as long as we're on this, there's one more little rant I want to make. Which is
please go ahead. Well, let me reintroduce you just to make sure that anyone who's just joining us knows who you are. Derek Jensen is the co-author of Strangely Like War, The Global Assault on Forests. It has a foreword by Vandana Shiva, a woman from India, which I want to ask Derek about in just a minute. And it's published by Chelsea Green Publishing. You can go to Chelsea, that's Chelsea, green.com. Yes, another rant, please.
Which is, I'm sure you heard in the 90s about the big jobs versus owls debate.
Sure, whether or not, they were saying you couldn't cut down these forests out in California because a spotted owl lived there, and these people were saying, hey, you're going to be destroying jobs for some little owl.
Right, and Washington and Oregon, too. And the thing is, the whole debate was just nonsense because it really should have been jobs versus automation, raw log exports, because all through the 80s and 90s, the cut had gone up. And the number of jobs had gone down because of automation primarily. And so any journalist with a shred of integrity would have not framed it as jobs versus owls, but instead would have framed it as jobs versus automation. Productivity in paper mills went up, productivity in sawmills went up, and jobs went down. And so it's all just nonsense, which reminds me, one more rant here, is that I'm sure you've heard also about Bush's Healthy Forest Initiative.
Yeah, he cares. He says he wants to.
Yeah. And the thing that's really interesting about this is that there's Robert J. Lifton, who's probably the world's foremost authority on the psychology of genocide, made very clear that before you can commit any awful act, that you have to convince yourself and others that what you're doing is not harmful but instead beneficial. And we see that with the Healthy Forest Initiative. They can't say, we want to hand over these trees to the big timber companies. Instead, they have to come up with what Robert J. Lifton called a claim to virtue. And that's true here, that the whole debate is really, in some ways, very frustrating because it's all based on lies and all based mm-hmm. on nonsense.
Well, actually, if I can quote off of my own website, peterwerby.com, Voltaire's quoted from the 18th century, anyone who has the power to make you believe absurdities has the power to make you commit injustices. And
it's a wonderful line.
Yeah, and part of it is, I mean, that's the value of books like yours, Derek Jensen, Strangely Like War, is that it gives people the information because you have the masters of deceit, the masters of disinformation. I was actually just getting an email criticism from a reader who said I was what a hypocrite I was because I was calling Rush Limbaugh, Pillhead Limbaugh, and asking why do you think they call him Rush? But he really is the master of disinformation. And one of the things that he says is that, hey, in any given year, there's more trees being planted than cut down. So don't worry about it, folks. Huh?
Well, do you want me to respond to that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, a couple of responses. The first one is that he's conflating things that aren't the same. And it is not only absurd but obscene to compare a 2,000-year-old tree that is, I mean, that's been alive for longer than our culture's been on this continent by four times, to compare that to a seedling. And that's the first thing. And the second thing is he's once again comparing apples and oranges by comparing a forest to a tree.
Mm-hmm.
And in any case, it's really absurd. Why don't we just say, you know what, there are more babies born every day than people killed, so why don't we just shoot you in the head?
Well, the other thing is, of course, in an area where you may, an old growth area, or you know, 100, 200, 500, 2,000-year-old trees, and if you cut down 100 of them, there's probably space enough to put in 10,000 seedlings. And you go, well, God, what a, you know? Look at this. Look at the ratio you have there. So another quote I'm fond of is from a social commentator around 1900, Mr. Dooley, who said that figures don't lie, but liars can figure.
Hmm.
And I think that's what we're looking at here. Well, I mentioned that the foreword to your wonderful book, Strangely Like War, is written by Vandana Shiva. And tell us the importance of Vandana Shiva as it connects to forest issues.
Well, she's probably the most important Indian activist and writer, Indian activist right now. By which I mean person from India, not American Indian. And she's been working on forest issues and also dam issues, water issues. I mean, they're all interrelated, and they're interrelated here, too. And she's been working on those issues over there for many, many years. And Strangely Like War is not really, I mean, it's not simply about American forests. It's also about globalization, because it's impossible to talk about deforestation without talking about the economic system. And one of the things that's driving a lot of deforestation is the whole global interconnectedness with, you know, destroying the forests of Indonesia so that people in Japan can have plywood for their concrete, what they called concrete forms, and so her importance to the book is that she is one of the foremost critics of globalization, foremost authorities on how globalization works and how it harms especially the poor and the natural world.
Now, wasn't she also like the original tree hugger? I mean, that's used as this derogatory remark. It's said with contempt by these people who seem to delight in destruction, our friends on the right. And am I remembering her that she was part of this movement that actually, that women went out and surrounded these trees and hugged them?
That movement actually goes back, I'm making up the number, but I'm going to say 500 years. It might be 200 years. I mean, it goes back hundreds of years. We can say that in India. It's called the Chipko Movement.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, it began with women who did not want the forests of their region to be cut. And so they would actually go out and put their bodies between the tree and the axe and hug the tree. And, you know, people talk about, you know, oh, those hippies these days who are, you know, trying to do civil disobedience to stop, you know, the cutting of the forest. Well, we got the Chipko movement, and then also this has been going on for a long time. There's Founders Grove of redwoods, which is south of here a ways, and the reason that was saved is because this woman in her 50s went out and laid down in front of the people with the saws back around 1910, 1905, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And Stout Grove, where I was just at with Mill Creek, with the old growth within 5 minutes of me, that was saved because a bunch of elderly women went out and fought to save it. And I mean, there's a long history of, and I guess all these things I'm mentioning are women. There's a long history of women and men, you know, fighting to stop this deforestation.
Well, oftentimes when I get email from right-wing critics. They call me, you tree-hugging, and I think, well, you know, why is it an insult? And so I do that. I want to be everything they accuse me of, everything that they hate. So, I mean, I want to hug trees. I want to dodge the draft. I want to burn my bra. I want to marry a guy. You know, I mean, anything just to say, hey, you know, people make certain choices. Well, never mind.
Well, have you literally hugged trees, by the way?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, this is actually quite a wonderful thing, not to get too woo-woo about this.
Let's go woo-woo.
It's a wonderful, and I've written about this, it's actually quite a wonderful feeling. Whenever I'm in town, I always, when I walk by trees, I always touch them and tell them I'm sorry that they're imprisoned in concrete.
okay, good.
And the other thing, as long as we're mentioning this, if you ever come to the West, find a ponderosa pine, and go up and put your nose in between the creases in the bark and smell it. They smell so good. They smell like a combination of vanilla and cinnamon.
I haven't actually done that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they have them in northern New Mexico. They're these mm-hmm. kind of ponderosas. Yeah, all right. So here, we're in Detroit City and all that. So we'll back up from the woo-woo. But, you know, there's very few people. I mean, there are some, you know, that don't like trees, that don't understand the importance of forests, very few people that do not understand the importance of habitation and all of that. The social forces that are, you know, the scythe that are cutting more and more trees, and I learned from your book, Strangely Like War, that how much of the deforestation, the logging, is illegal in the world and also here in the United States.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Internationally, I don't remember the number off the top of my head, but I believe it's about 50%, isn't it?
I think it's in your book, yeah.
Yeah, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 50% of all the logging in the world is just illegal. So people talk about, oh, there's great regulations. Well, big deal. And then the other part about that is that both in the United States and around the world, timber theft is not very high on the list of prosecutable items. It's something that doesn't happen very often. In fact, there was a timber theft task force was assembled by the Forest Service several years ago, and they discovered all sorts of Operation Rodeo, I believe it was called, and they were finding that many, many of the big corporations were just stealing wholesale from the federal government, which of course is not a surprise. I mean, that's how things work in, you know, military procurement and all that stuff too. So it's no surprise they're stealing from the feds. They're stealing from the public, really, is what it means. Anyway, when the task force started to close in on them, first off, the Forest Service started shredding documents like mad and was going out and changing contracts to retroactively to make it so. And the way they were stealing is that they would have a boundary where they could cut, and then of course they would go across the boundary and cut beyond that, or they would put one type, more expensive type of tree below on the logging truck, and then they would put the top would be a cheaper tree, and they would mess with the log scales, all that stuff, the weigh scales. Anyway, that's what the local Forest Service people did because they didn't want to harm their relationship with the corporate people they were working with. And then what the feds did, and this went all the way up to the White House, and there are beliefs that Clinton was actually gave the specific order to do this. They actually disbanded the timber theft task force. And as always, they said, oh, we're doing this to streamline it and make it better, blah, blah, blah. But they gutted it, and then nowadays its prosecutions are limited to thefts of, I think, $5,000, which is, you know, the effect of, I mean, that's basically people stealing Christmas trees and firewood and stuff.
We don't have a lot of time left, and I don't know why lately I've gotten so sensitive to my conservative critics. Not like I'm going to act in terms of what they say, but I am always thinking about arguments to the contrary.
Right.
One of the things that they say is that all they ever get out of my shows is complaints and how bad everything is, and I think things are pretty bad in terms of our environment. And what about, in fact, well, maybe I use the end shows with quotes from the back of the book. People have endorsed it, and the wonderful Frances Moore LePay, who co-authored a book that